This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard.
Not billiard.
What?
Not the billiards. It was...
Come on, everybody. What? Come on. We call it
the place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Lawson Bram, skidamarinky-dinky-dink.
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-do.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening. And Scott Criscola, we're back in the saddle here on the mothership, sir. How are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 434 of the Gold Standard. And we took a detour down the L.I. L.E. out to Uniondale, but now we're back in our comfy haunts in Manhattan on 33rd Street. Mm-hmm. Did you have a nice weekend?
Yeah, it was 50-50. It was really nice because Mr. D'Amato made the trek in from New mm-hmm. York. We went to a PC game. We got some wings, so it was a good time. Mm-hmm. And but my son was quite sick. Actually, it was a really rough week across the board. So my wife and I had a really bad stomach bug early in the week, Tuesday, Wednesday-ish. And then we got over that, and then Thursday night he started, and he had croup. So that's been a rough few days. So
I didn't even know that still existed.
It exists.
I thought it was like whooping cough, you know?
Yeah. But D'Amato got a lot of doll playing in, so it was good.
I saw that. Yeah, he looked settled right in. Yeah.
And Juliana woke him up at, I believe, 5:45 on Sunday. So
Nah, she doesn't do that. For me, it's usually like 8:30. Yeah, usually know better.
And how are you? Your weekend?
Good. Yeah, not bad. Usual weekend. Watched a decent amount of football, and yeah, it was a good weekend. And heartbroken. Great game yesterday, but c'est la vie. You know, what are you gonna do? Start of hopefully a good run. I dealt with a lot of annoying Facebook memes, like I do every Monday morning. But whatever, it's the way it is. But I'm looking forward to visiting. Usually I do in January. Couldn't do it this time, but that's okay. I'll be in soon. But tonight, it is always good to be with you. I'm looking forward to this show. I feel like I've watched that Science Main Event like 1,000 times, so it's good to get back to the. It's good to get back kind of back into something. And this is a great show. I mean, this is a great.
It was loaded.
This is a great show.
We hinted at it last month, but Scott, we're not alone. For the second week
in
a row, we have a very special guest. Yeah, this is a guy we've been trying to get for a few weeks, but due to some internet issues and otherwise, New Year, holiday, and everything else, we pushed it back a bit. But it is happening here tonight. It is going to be happening because this guy has been a listener and a fan and a friend almost since the start of our show, Scott. And he's been on the show before, but he's never done a Vintage Vault review with us. And we thought, given the topic and where we're at in our timeline, I thought this was very fitting to finally bring in the co-host of Where the Big Boys Play, the co-host of Titans of Wrestling, the co-host of Letters from Kayfabe, and the host of your bi-weekly, twice-weekly Pod Blast series here on the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. And that is the one and only Parv. Parv, how are you tonight, my friend?
Well, thank you very much for the big introduction there.
Yeah, I've been saving that one for like 5 years.
What's all this co-host bit? I thought it was just the host. What's all this co-host
bit? I'm waiting for him to like throw Alan through the barbershop window or something. Look out, Chad.
Oh, Chad's given up long ago. I was trying to be nice to Chad. I feel like I always bury Chad, so I figured the co-host thing at least gave him a little rub, you know?
That's fun. But it's good to finally have you on, Parv.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And, you know, we had you on Where the Big Boys Play back in whenever it was, 2012 or whatever it was. And it's only taken you 4 years for doing the favor. So
there you are. Well, in fairness, we didn't think you'd want to talk about like 2002, you know, Unforgiven or anything like that. So,
well, you were completely correct about that. So
we're back in the wheelhouse tonight. All right. So, yeah, Scott, we are. Why don't you set us up? And then not only do we have Sutton facts tonight, we have a couple of Jarvis facts in our Jeff Jarvis notes as well. So
excellent. And Parv, and I didn't do this for Mr. Everett last week, but I kind of added a little bit to the pop culture report in our mid portion of the show. So something to get you settled in. Something that went on in your neck of the woods in 1985. Unfortunately, it was a sad one, but something obviously noteworthy worth mentioning in sports. But we'll get there. Tonight, JR and Parv, we're going to go back into our beautiful cylindrical palace known as Madison Square Garden. We're in our palatial offices. And it is May 20th, 1985. We are on the Monday, about 9 days after the Saturday night's main event we did last week. Mm-hmm. 10 days from the taping, 9 days from when it aired. And we're heading into Memorial Day weekend. So that is where we are. Now, let's double check before we continue on and see. I'm sure Sutton and I don't know if Jeffrey did, but we'll see if Sutton added it, but I like beating him to the punch and then he complains about it. Let's see what else was going on that evening, because
they
obviously
did add it. So, okay. I can
they did.
It.
All right. Well, we'll hop in. Let's see. There was one other show. Mm-hmm. It was 3,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. It was at the Coliseum in Oakland.
Sure was.
6,000. Here's the card quickly. Les Thornton pinned Sal Bellomo. Wendy Richter successfully defended her women's championship. She beat Moolah, who was a sub for Mad Maxine, which is Matt Rotella in drag. Mr. Wrestling 2 defeated Matt Bourne. Junkyard Dog defeated Barry O. George Wells defeated Moondog Spot. A guy we're about to mention briefly, because he was a member of Madison Square Garden and WWF lore that passed away recently, Ricky Steamboat, and the late, sometimes great, sometimes not, Jimmy Superfly Snuka defeated Cowboy Bob Orton and Alexis Smirnoff, who was a sub for the Hot Rod, Roddy Piper.
What a drop.
Alexis. I know, yeah. And the main event was your Intercontinental Champion, Greg the Hammer Valentine, defeated Tito Santana in a lumberjack match. Now, as we mentioned, and we'll just mention it quickly, of course, this past weekend, we did lose Jimmy Superfly Snuka. I believe he was 73 to stomach cancer. Very quickly, I'm just going to say he was my first favorite wrestler. He was the first guy. The first two wrestlers I ever saw as a fan was Jimmy Snuka and Parv's other favorite wrestler of all time, the Magnificent Morocco. And, of course, the match that hooked me, and it's probably still my favorite Snuka match of all time, is October 17th, 1983 at Madison Square Garden in the steel cage for the Intercontinental title, when Snuka jumped off the top of the cage. And, of course, God, who was there? Tommy Dreamer, Bubba Ray Dudley, Mick Foley, you know, a bunch of guys were in the crowd. So that was probably my favorite Snuka match of all time.
Yeah, obviously, like you mentioned, Scott, a lot of controversy around Snuka. Not a guy we want to glorify by any means, so just a quick memory, I guess, of him. I mean, by the time I started watching, he was pretty much already a jobber, but even then he had an allure. Like, you could tell he had been somebody, you know. They spoke of him reverently enough on air. that you knew he had been something beyond just a jobber to the stars, which is kind of what he was by the time I started watching. So I guess my biggest memory would probably be the coconut, and then reliving the feud many years later, through the Roddy Piper Coliseum home video, him and Piper and Tonga Kid and all that stuff as it unfolded in 84. So that's probably my main highlight of Snuka. How about you, Parv?
Well, I don't know so much about memory, but in terms of the best snooker match I've seen, and this is going to sound very Chad-like here, but 12-13-81 from All Japan, Bruiser Brody and Jimmy Snooker versus the Funk Brothers, Dory and Terry Funk. That is at least a 4-star match, and that's one I'd recommend seeking out from him. He could actually go, you know, a good bit when he was younger. I'm never a great fan of snooker or anything myself, but that is a good performance. He really can. He plays like the face in peril throughout that tag, and that's one I'd recommend.
He was important too in the early days of ECW, helping them kind of get reestablished when they split off, and even before Extreme. But when they were Eastern, but still trying to forge that identity. He was one of the names you'd see crop up in, like, PWI, him and Tito Santana and Morocco. Like, all those guys, you'd see them pop up in this promotion. Like, what the hell? These guys are here, you know? And it's funny to go back and rewatch some of that stuff on the network in those very early days of ECW. But he was a name for them at that point.
I will say that Bob, prior to the Morocco feud, he does have a good couple of matches with Bob Backlund as well. Mm-hmm. They're worth seeing because... He's still technically a heel, but he's so over with that crowd at that time.
I agree.
And I guess that's something that people don't talk about that much, is that Snooker was huge. I mean, just before Hogan comes in, he was getting mega reactions. So,
and that was the
something
match.
Worth...
And that was the first time he jumped off the cage, too, right? It was the Backlund match. He misses, and then he hits it on Morocco.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
yep.
Jimmy Snooker. Yep. There you go.
Jimmy Snooker, gone at the age of 73. One more thing happened, by the way, before we move on. One more thing happened on May 20th. Actually, a title change, JR, happened even further away than Oakland. Involved a guy that we saw in April at our house show. The Cobra lost the World Wrestling Federation Junior Heavyweight Championship in Hiroshima to Hiro Saito.
There you go.
I don't think that's Mr. Saito. Maybe it's his son, or maybe it's just a random guy whose last name happens to be Saito. But that I'm not sure about. But we do have a new World Wrestling Federation Junior Heavyweight Champion. And he actually won the match via disqualification. So I don't know if there was a weird rule involved there. So that also happened on this day.
That Mr. Saito is a reasonably well-known mid-card Japanese guy who was knocking around at that time.
Okay.
It's just a different – it's not the Mr. Saito, though.
I didn't think so. I was just curious.
Just one little note. That Wendy Richter versus Moolah match, surely that wasn't a clean pin. Surely there was some shenanigans in the finish there. I can't believe that Moolah was getting pinned anywhere, ever.
Yeah, I'm just seeing what's on Graham Cawthon's History of WWE.com. All it says is WWF Women's Champion Wendy Richter defeated the Fabulous Moolah, and in parentheses it says sub for Mad Maxine, a.k.a. Matt Rotel and Drag.
So it could have been a DQ or something.
Yeah, there might have been
pinned, right? It just says defeated.
Yeah, it doesn't say pinned. It just says defeated. Yeah, actually, it says defeated. So, yeah. Although a lot of them say defeated, only one says pinned, and that's Les Thornton pinning Sal Palomo.
So Saito actually popped up at Wrestle Kingdom this year. By the way, he was in the New Japan Rumble. He had not wrestled in quite a while, it seems. So there you go.
Interesting. 15,000 at the Garden on this Monday evening. There was no screen at the although I'm surprised they didn't put like a screen over at the Felt Forum or the theater for the extra 7,000 or 8,000, because this card's pretty loaded. So I'm kind of surprised that they didn't put an extra screen. They usually do that for when a house show has a certain sachet to it. But they didn't do it on this evening. All right, JR, give us our Sutton report and our Mr. JJ facts.
All right, Sutton report. Here's our championship roll call. Hulk Hogan, 483 days into his reign as WWF champion. Greg Valentine, 238 days into his reign. The Foreign Legion, as Mr. Sutton likes to call them, of course, Volkov and Sheik, 50 days into their reign. Wendy Richter, 50 days into her reign. Of course, they both won at WrestleMania. Rocky Johnson, we'll talk about in a few minutes, his final Madison Square Garden appearance. So
Yeah.
We'll be talking about that. Jeff Jarvis lets us know some facts that have happened since our last house show in April. On April 27th episode of Dirty F Championship Wrestling, Bobby Heenan appeared on Piper's Pit and revealed that Paul Orndorff had fired him as his manager. And, of course, George Animal Steel made his return in a six-man tag with the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, and then would later turn on Saturday Night's Main Event, which premiered on May 11th, the first network wrestling broadcast since Scott Criscolo was on his couch watching on the Dumont Network back in the day. On May 18th, WWF Championship Wrestling, Bobby Heenan then brought out a briefcase for $25,000, offering a bounty for anyone that could beat up Paul Orndorff severely enough to put him out of wrestling forever. So big bounty angle going on here. And also, finally, on May 18th, the WWF broadcast their first televised card from the Boston Garden on NESN. Main event of that show was Hulk Hogan and Jimmy Snuka against Bob Orton and Magnificent Morocco. So there you go. This is your Jarvis facts. Are you a fan of bounty angles, Parv?
No, they can be done reasonably well. I mean, I always think of Flair Race as a bounty angle.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Heenan was a good guy to do it too, because he can talk it out so well. Like, we've been watching some of those TNT, Scott, and he's on there talking about it, and it works well with him to do it.
Definitely. I agree. No other manager could pull that off in WWF at the moment. Not Jimmy, or I wouldn't even say a Fuji could barely understand. Jimmy Hart, nah, he's too goofy. Johnny Valiant's too white trashy.
It was Bobby and a high level angle that makes it work.
So. Yeah, exactly. So, once again, we have the open is very cool. Because I find it very odd. I want to ask you this, Parv, because this is the second straight month that we've had that this happened, where the opening of the show, Gorilla Monsoon is actually doing billboards for like advertisers that you never hear WWF do. Newer fans may hear, you know, Michael Cole does the occasional, you know, brought to you by, you know, whatever, Mountain Dew Kick or whatever the hell it is. But to hear like Gorilla do, you know, Manufacturers Hanover, TWA, Planters, and like all these weird, what did you think when you were watching it and hearing like these, like something that you would never hear Gorilla do? And it's not kind of wild.
Yeah, this stuff all seems kind of new for 85 to me. It's like, because I've been watching a lot of the older MSG shows, and this sort of thing doesn't really happen that much. Mm-hmm. Like even some of the credits and things looked new, you know, right. Rebranded to me.
I agree. No, I agree. And also weird, like, they strictly used to promote just WWF. Like, the pictures would all be wrestlers. But now, they're – I mean, maybe this is a precursor to how Vince thinks now, but it was almost like they were considering – MSG as a brand, because, you know, they would show the Knicks, they'd show the Rangers, they'd show Golden Gloves, the Big East, you know, Georgetown, you know, they showed PC, Syracuse, they would show, you know, figure skating, like anything. So I feel like they turned it into a brand rather than just a building that events happen in. You know what I mean? That's what it seems like to me. So.
Yeah, I mean, this weird, like, who got this MSG network, though? It really only went out to a small area, though, right? Like, in and around New York?
Kind of both. I think it was local to the New York area, but I think people also with either really advanced cable packages or dish, satellite dishes could pick it up as well. I'm pretty sure, right, Scott?
I always hear this thing that somehow in Florida they always got Vince's TV.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Dr. G, when he lived in Florida, he got MSG, and he also got Channel 9 and some of the local Channel 11, because he used to watch the Yankees.
I think part of that is a lot of retirees from New York go down to Florida, so maybe it was like, something where the Florida cable companies would, you know, reach deals to bring the programming down there because they'd want to watch the local sports teams or keep up with the local news.
Like Seinfeld's parents, for example.
There you go. That's it right there. And that's a very accurate description as well. So.
Yep. So I don't know. I just thought it was wild. We talked about it at the last house show, and I was curious your thoughts on it, because hearing Gorilla, who was very – and, you know, it's funny. Back then, everybody was very wrestling-centric. Like, anytime you heard a wrestling personality kind of go out of their comfort zone – you can always hear like the kind of nervousness, like Gorilla, who was always very smooth in his delivery. Yeah. Him trying to read the liners sounded almost a little out of his element. T- TWA. Your airline, TWA. Like, it's like so stiff, and, you know. Anyway, this is the second straight month.
I'd have had Gene doing it, personally.
Right, that would have made sense.
I think Oakland would have killed it doing that, because he's just a natural shill for anything.
Yeah, I agree 100%. No, you're right about that. All right, why don't we dive in, get into the garden. We got, let's see, 1, 2, 3... Let's see, 4, 5, 6. I think we have 9 matches. 8 will be on this show. One match that we will mention later on got cut from the copy that we watched. So there's one match that won't be here. Nothing earth shattering, no. Believe me.
I was fine. Not seeing that match.
Yeah, we're better off actually missing it, but we'll tell you what it is in a little bit. We'll tell you what it is when we get to the slot that it was in. All right, we open, as JR mentioned, with a guy who will be making his farewell appearance here at the Garden. And that is the Soul Man, Rocky Johnson. And Rocky will be taking on a usual MSG curtain-jerking veteran from Nice, France. And that is Mr. René Goulet, who is studded gloveless on this night. And, of course...
So usually he jerks the curtain with that studded glove, but...
Yes, but of course, me and Gene, who loves to mention the studded glove, apparently it was stolen or something. But anyway, JR, a little background if we have any.
So, well, no background, but here's the match itself. Rocky Johnson's back in the opener, reestablishing himself. Again, gets a nice pop from MSG. Goulet not welcomed nearly as warmly. Gorilla tells us somebody stole Goulet's studded glove, and apparently he's quite pissed off about it, but he has some sort of alternative glove on instead. We get a lockup and stalemate to start. That Goulet tries to work out some amateur holds, but Rocky powers out. Rocky flashes his great speed, rattling Goulet until trapping him in an armbar. Gene and Gorilla put over Rocky greatly, say Goulet doesn't have what it takes to win a match like this. Rocky keeps a hold of the arm until Goulet wriggles free and bails out to the apron to regroup. Goulet comes back in and trades punches with Rocky, but Rocky dodges them and grabs a side headlock. Goulet tries to force a rope break. Rocky drags him back in and drops him on his face. Gorilla and Gene then discuss that Bobby Heenan $25,000 bounty on Orndorff and briefly tease a monsoon comeback for it. Goulet goes to the tights and is able to crack Rocky with a foreign object to turn the tide. Goulet works over Rocky with a barrage of strikes and chokes and then hooks on the scorpion claw hold. Rocky finally fights to his knees and punches free. But he wildly charges and slams hard into the corner. Goulet hits an elbow off the second rope and goes right back to the claw again. Rocky fights free and is able to roll up Goulet for the win. I thought really nothing to see here. Standard opener for Goulet, who uses his claw hold just way too much. I mean, that's all he does is go to that fucking claw. Rocky looked good again, buzzing around the ring, showing off his power. I thought it was a fine opener. Didn't really overstay its welcome. It was quick enough, and I went a half star. Parv, what did you think of this opener here?
Went on far too long for what it was. I mean, most of my notes for all of the show are about commentary. And I wanted to ask you guys, really, how much Mean Gene have you seen on play-by-play or on color? Not something you see that often, and you're getting it in these early 85 shows. So what do you make of Mean Gene?
Yeah, so... I think this is what, our fifth one with him, Scott, maybe?
He's done all of them except... I think he's done every show... Except Mania.
So yeah. I think he's been better than I had remembered, but I thought where he really shined, Parv, was at Water Settle the Score when he had to turn it on for the MTV cameras in that main event. Like, that to me is when his polish and why he's important shone through. Like, I think he did a much better job than Gorilla would have done. But I think on just the match-to-match, a little too sing-songy for me, like a little too... polished in a way, which is funny to say because you think you'd want a polished guy, but he's almost too straight announcer right out of the, you know, traditional playbook of play-by-play men, you know. So it was kind of that tone versus someone that can really jab with Gorilla.
I did enjoy his little story during this match about he talks about a time where he went out with René Goulet and Goulet got a round in and then he didn't pick up the tab. Like what was it? He didn't when he turned around to give the money, he was gone or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I think it was.
I enjoyed that little story, but I also enjoyed was he criticizing Goulet's glove, like saying he's had it for 20 years or something like that?
Ben Hogan gave it to him in 1937 or whatever. He beat that story into the ground.
They're all over that glove every month. Every month, Gene is all over that glove.
Two things Mean Gene beat into the ground. René Goulet's glove and Moondog Spot's bone.
Yes.
I mean, he killed those to death. And, I mean, I got to be honest with you, Parv, I'm not a Mean Gene fan as a commentator. It's not bad enough. I shouldn't say that. it's okay to have mean to have Gorilla as the milquetoast, you know, babyface play-by-play guy, but and he, I mean, even Gorilla's not bitching and moaning because Gorilla was a worker, so he can. But to hear Mean Gene piss and moan every 2 minutes, oh, he should be disqualified immediately. Give me a break! Like everybody should be disqualified. Everybody should be, you know, good guys should win everything. I mean, it got a little tiresome, and I'm kind of glad we switched gears about halfway through this show, and this is probably where Mean Gene stopped. We'll see as the shows continue. But
well, Parv, you and I thought you and Alan actually covered it nicely last week on Letters when you went through the history of the was it like the talk show programs. You kind of covered Gene, how they transitioned him to the host role where he was better suited and he got his own program. Was it like All American around this time or whatever?
Yeah, he actually started to host All Star as the host. I think when Oakland first came in from the AWA, Vince felt like he had to put him in everything.
Right.
Like, have him in the booth, have him hosting, have him, almost like showing him off type thing. But I think they basically figured out that his value was as the interview guy, not as a commentator. And I guess by 85, 86 sort of time, there were so many interviews that had to be done. Mm-hmm. And so many little host spots or... because that's Gene's value, basically, isn't it? It's as the anchor in the studio.
He's a great pitch man and a great hype man. I mean, that's, you know, that's a help. He believably sells you on what's coming up.
Doesn't he start presenting TNT around this time as well?
I think it's a little bit later. Because we're still watching. I'm in May of 85 anyway, watching the TNT Network Adventure, and it's still Vince.
At some point, Gene takes over that.
Yeah, I'm going to look up now when he takes over.
I feel like it's like late 85.
Yeah, let me see. Like I'll take a look.
It's at some point in 85. Yeah. And I think you get a big transition where it's pretty clear that Gene's not going to do any commentary anymore. And it may even be the show, because I can't remember too many times where Gene is in the booth after 85.
Definitely not.
They're very rare for him to be on commentary. So it's just interesting to hear him, really. Match was nothing, though. One star.
Okay. Scott, what do you think of the match?
Yeah, Graham doesn't have – he just has all the dates of the episodes, but he doesn't have anything specific. Mm. So I'm not sure when he took over. This match is all right. I mean, Rocky, I don't know where he got his tights. This is like to get into like the ancillary stuff. But at one point, his tights were very baggy because at one point, like, Rene Goulet's holding him and it looks like a big diaper. I don't know. It's like all folded funny. And he definitely, it just looked weird. He didn't fit into his white tights for some reason. There was a lot of posturing early on, a lot of staring around, and it took forever to get going. And to back up your point, Parv, I thought at this point, I was surprised hearing Mean Gene. I thought he was done at this point. I know he started 1985, but I thought at this point he was done.
So actually, it looks like Gene takes over in 86.
For TNT?
Yeah, for TNT. So I think Vince finishes the year and then Gene takes over. I remember it's the dying days. Like, I remember Gene, it was some DVD or something, he comments about how Vince gave it to him because he knew it was dying, so he wanted out when he gave it to Gene.
Oh, no surprise there. I got nothing else on this one. I gave it a star. I mean, it was all right. It wasn't anything great. You could tell Rocky was, you know, working his dates and finishing it off, and you know.
Now, do you guys like Rocky? Because I've never really been. I've been very unimpressed with all the Rocky Johnson I've seen since I've gone back and watched. Did you like him as a worker?
No, he's a guy that I get why he was over at this time. I'll put it that way. Like, pretty good animation, pretty good getting the crowd fired up. He had a great look, you know, chiseled and. He was fast for his guy, but I think when it came to like actually putting together a quality match, I think he's severely lacking. But I think he had what it took to be a star in the exact point that he was a star.
He had a good look, and we're going to have a few guys tonight because we have one of our awards could pertain to Rocky Johnson, which we'll get to at the conclusion. The match, I think length killed it. I mean, it was 10-19. I mean, that's a little long for a lot of posturing and not much of anything else. And you know, claws and that kind of stuff.
That claw. Yeah, I mean, he was. Claw.
Yeah, it was definitely. He was definitely. You know, just a good, solid character with, decent power ability and quick speed. He had quick punches, and even Gorilla mentions his great boxing credentials. That's about all you got out of Rocky Johnson. There wasn't really much more of anything else. And I'm not surprised that Vince decided after this date that he could, you know, he could move on. So I gave it a star as well. Match length 10:19. Mm-hmm. Felt like about 49. I think 10:19 was on one claw. I felt like it was 22:19. So, all right, next up. when I saw the graphics come on the screen, I'm like, oh Jesus God, no. Oh God. Go ahead, JR. I'll pass this one off to you. Who's right. our participants?
Well, let's cover off on Joseph Bednarski, a Polish immigrant that migrated to Texas at a young age and eventually joined the pro wrestling circuit in 1968 as Ivan Putski. Putski would work across the Midwest, Texas, and eventually the AWA using various gimmicks, including runs as a lucky dimwit and concentration camp survivor. He would sign on with Vince McMahon Sr.'s WWF in 1974. I feel like there's a few people in Place of the Nation that are lucky dimwits. And would become embroiled in memorable feuds with Bruiser Brody, Ivan Koloff, and Stan Hansen. In October 1979, Putski teamed with Tito Santana to win the tag team titles. Bounced around the country, still competing with WWF as a lower mid-card talent as the 80s rolled on. And, of course, infamously called by Jesse Ventura as a Paduski on many a show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So tonight he is taking on a Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Scott, we saw him a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. You were not impressed. I thought he was okay as a power bruiser. But here we are taking on his Ivan Paduski. Neidhart continuing his trek up the card against the old school veteran who's actually slimmed down quite a bit. If you remember back in the early 80s, he had that big paunchy gut. But he's also jacked way the fuck up on the other end. So he's not as brawny as he used to be, but he is cut and chiseled. And we'll be talking about him quite a bit, I think, later on. So Putski gets a large pop from the crowd as we get underway. Get a lock up to start, but that goes to a stalemate. Putski grabs a side headlock as Gorilla knows that Jimmy Hart is not here with the anvil. Both powerhouses collide hard in the middle of the ring with neither budging, so Neidhart steps to the apron to regroup. Putski continues to frustrate Neidhart, tripping him up and clobbering him in the back of the head. Things went to the mat from there as Neidhart grabbed the side headlock, but Putski turned that into a head scissors. Neidhart forced the rope break and then regained control, went to a chin lock before bopping him on the head with an elbow. Gene calls Neidhart arrogant as he hammers away at Putski. The crowd rallies Ivan as he powers up and slugs away in a wild flurry. Putski cracks Neidhart with a hammer to a huge pop, but Neidhart rolls out to the apron. Putski tries to slam him back in, but Neidhart shifts his weight and collapses on top. I thought this was really boring. I thought it was really awkward. It was at least somewhat short. The final sequence, I thought, were a little bit hot as Neidhart survives. The crowd was really into Putski, though. They loved him here, so his legacy lives on in the garden. I went with a pure dud for this match, Scott. What did you think?
Oh, yeah, this is easily a dud. Your match length is 6:04, which is about 5:53 too long. Ivan Putski is atrocious. And Neidhart, at least, is, I guess, an up-and-comer per se. But, I mean, he's just – I mean, this match is atrocious. And Ivan Putski, I mean, for God's sakes, at least – I mean, 19 – if you look at the earlier MSG shows when he first when he was first on the scene, say, in 75, 76. I mean, he's a big dude, but he had a beer belly and – you know, he was drinking beer after matches and that kind of stuff. Now it's friggin' 9 years later, and good grief! I mean, you talk about an award later. I mean, based on who's on this card, the Diana ball must have been flying all over the locker room during this show. I mean, he's just ridiculously jacked here, and no surprise why. He probably wanted to keep his spot on the card and kind of, you know,
or maybe he's the arrogant guys. One, not the anvil. Maybe Putski is juicing himself up like this.
Paduski is. Exactly. Paduski is the arrogant one. Yeah, this match is atrocious, and I give it a dud, too. Parv?
Yeah, well, I mean, I absolutely hate Ivan Putski with a passion. I've said it before that... Did either of you guys used to play Super Mario Brothers 3
for the
Nintendo? Do you remember that little boss, like the guy that you'd face in the castle?
Yes.
Yeah,
I've always thought Ivan Putski looks like that because his arms are kind of like, you know, like how his arms go out so by the side and up and down.
Yes, I've always
thought that Ivan Putski has got like those little, like his arms are too little for his body somehow. It's kind of weird. Like he's a very odd shaped man.
Well, that's what happens when you're on 14 cycles at the same time.
It's insane. I mean, for talent to overness ratio, Putski's got to be... I don't know if anyone's worse than Putski for how over he was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even Strongbow could do a few things.
Right. But
Putski is like really the drizzling, you know, the worst.
Other than that double hammer nonsense, was there really anything else?
Bloody awful. Anyway, this was a very sloppy match, and I've just written here, I am glad that Putski was reduced to jobbing to Jim Neidhart at this point. He deserved it. Dud. Pure dud. It's awful.
Yeah, it was not good. It was not good. I mean, Neidhart's not the guy to carry him in any way either. You know what I mean? He's just out there chugging along. Who did he fight that other one, Scott? Was it Garea? No, who was the match he had that you hated and I thought was okay? Do you remember that one? That was a few months ago.
It was it wasn't Tony Garea. It was the one in April. Let me see.
Was it April or March? I think it was March.
Maybe it was the show right before Mania with the.
Yeah, I might
need to take a
anyway,
look.
Oh, was there? No, it wasn't Rods. Anyway, you can look that up.
No, I'll take a look. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, nothing special here at all. What would you think of Anvil at this point, Parv? Any thoughts specifically on him? I mean, did you see anything in him besides? Obviously, you know what he'd become, the anchor of a tag team, but did you see anything of him as potential as a singles guy, like during the stretch?
No, I mean, not really, to be honest. He just seemed like a guy. I don't know. Does Jim Neidhart ever become more than that in his career, do you think? Like, more than just a guy?
No, and I think I think he would fizzle out a lot more quickly if he didn't get paired with Brett.
It was March 17th. It was SD Jones.
Okay, that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, it was SD Jones. The match was, as Parv said, the drizzling. We don't have to go any further than that. not a fan. Not a fan.
I guess he wasn't a bad promo in his day. Neidhart, was he like he did the little goatee laugh thing that he did later on?
So I'm guessing Jimmy Hart was probably in Oakland with Greg Valentine.
He must have been, because he definitely wasn't here.
Yeah. Who else? Was there any other? Was there any other Jimmy Hart guys?
Brett.
Yeah, was he with Brett? He was with Brett by now, right?
Yeah, he was.
Were there any other Jimmy Hart guys in Oakland?
Oh,
I'm looking at the card now. Oh, no, it was just Valentine. He was just there. He was probably there.
Well,
with
it makes sense. Of the three guys, I mean, that's his biggest client. So,
yeah,
it made sense to have him out there. But anyway, there you go. Putski loses.
Yeah.
That's all we care
about. A drizzler, as instead of a dud, we'll call it the Parv Drizzler.
Yeah. Instead of the worst match of the night, we'll call it the drizzler. That'll be
the drizzler.
Worst match of the night.
Yes, there you go. In 604. All right, next up, we have a big return. We saw him, he came in and like waved, I think back in January, I think our first card, he came and did one of his, kind of like the late Jimmy Snuka did at WrestleMania 5. He just kind of showed up at the minute before a match. It was kind of bizarre. And then we didn't see him, but now he's making his in-ring return, the first ever Triple Crown winner in World Wrestling Federation history. Of course, I'm talking about from Culebra, Puerto Rico, and that is, of course, Pedro Morales, and he is taking on the iconic Terry Gibbs, JR.
Pedro began his career on the West Coast in 1959, competing against major regional stars of that era, eventually winning the WWA heavyweight title, moved to the WWF in 1970, winning the heavyweight title from Ivan Koloff in 1971, had a very successful reign, catching on with the heavy Puerto Rican fan base in New York City. 1972 had an epic showdown, Bruno Sammartino and Shea Stadium, marking the first ever WWF title match between two top-level faces. The match ended in a 75-minute draw. Morales dropped the title to Stan Stasiak in December 73 before fading for the promotion, began traveling to various territories throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico before returning to the WWF in May of 80. After winning tag team gold with Bob Backlund, Morales set his sights on the only title he had yet to win, the IC title strap. He accomplished his goal on December 8th, 1980, a day after yours truly was born, defeating champion Ken Patera. With the win, Morales became the first WWF Triple Crown winner, would briefly lose the title to Don Morocco, but when he won it back, he became the first two-time IC champ, and also went on to have a record-setting 14-month reign as champion. Morocco ended that reign in early 83. Over the next 2 years, Morales split his time between Puerto Rico's WWEC and the WWF, eventually settling in the lower mid-card and putting over rising stars for Vince McMahon through the end of 87. Eventually retired, did some Spanish language announcing for the WWF, and was inducted to the Hall of Fame in 1995. Terry Gibbs back this month, ready for another big match. Pedro Morales back on the scene as well, gets a warm welcome from the MSG faithful. Gibbs keeps stalling, ducking out of the ropes and avoiding Pedro. Gibbs finally engages, and we get some mat work from both men trading holds, and that eventually ends with Pedro working the arm. Gibbs wriggles free, but Pedro keeps bringing the heat with wild left hands. Pedro went back to the arm, but Gibbs got to the ropes and finally sucker punches Pedro to take over the match. Pedro lands a couple of shots, but Gibbs maintains control and goes to an abdominal stretch. Pedro breaks free, but Gibbs reverses across body and hits an atomic drop for a near fall. Gibbs slings Morales into the floor and follows him outside, slamming him into the guardrail, and then rolls back in. Pedro recovers and yanks Gibbs to the floor and pounds him out there to a big pop. Gibbs rolls back in and begs off, but Morales brings the heat, unleashing a flurry of offense before turning Gibbs into a Boston Crab for the win. I thought this was really blah until they went to the floor. I thought that final stretch actually saved things just a little bit. The crowd was super into Pedro, but all that stalling and nonsense in the first three quarters of the match for me really killed it. I thought Gibbs has good heel basics, but just drags him out too long. Like, what could be done in two sets of stalling is it becomes like seven for him. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to back away and go to the corner and look around like five times instead of one. And I went half a star here, just mainly for that last stretch once they hit the floor. Parv, what do you think of the match? And then what do you think of Pedro?
Well, it's interesting, JR, you've just done the Pedro Morales bio,
yeah.
I noticed. And that's a little running in-joke that we've had on Titans that I don't think anybody ever got or has ever mentioned, which is that Pedro was the only wrestler never to get a bio on there for some reason.
Oh, really?
I don't know why we kept on doing that.
Well, you can cut that out right there if you want and put it into his next match and you're good to go.
I'll tell you about the match first. Again, all of my notes are about commentary. One of the things is that I really love the idea that in the Terry Gibbs playbook, there's no counter for the basic chicken wing. This is something that Gorilla Monsoon was talking about, that Gibbs hasn't got a counter for the chicken wing. And they sat in it for a good, like, 3 minutes, didn't they?
He can't figure out a way out. That's it. He's stuck in there.
And then I think he went to, like, a poke in the eye or something as his ghetto.
Yes. Yep.
It was also really funny that at one point, Mean Gene asked Monsoon if he thinks that Pedro's lost any speed.
Yes.
Monsoon said, I can't really answer that because they haven't really moved yet. Like about 4 minutes
ago. Right.
So that was an unintentional, complete burying of the match. This was also like a really typical Morales structure, which actually meant that Terry Gibbs got a lot of time on top. And I'm not sure if Gibbs knew what to do with that time. So I thought this was a really poor match. Mm-hmm. I gave it a dud. I thought it was awful.
I had dud queued up, but that I enjoyed when we went to the floor because the crowd got so hot into it. And I thought like those final like minute was pretty good. But up until that, it was putting me to fucking sleep. And I felt bad because I'm like, oh, it's Pedro. I should kind of. And I'm like, oh, this is dreadful. Like, why'd he ever come back? And I mean, three matches into this card. And I'm like, oh, I was looking forward to this one. What'd you think, Scott?
I agree with you, JR. I was about to go dud, and then I actually went with a half star. Our duration was 12:15, which seemed very long. I feel like Pedro, I don't know if he had not been in the ring for a while, but he definitely seemed a little out of sorts, a little rusty. Then early in the match, I'm sure you caught this part. I'm sure both of you caught it. Pedro, when he was like, they were just exchanging punches, and Pedro totally whiffed. I mean, totally whiffed on a punch early on. And even Gorilla goes, he barely paint on as he paintbrushes him. I'm like, no, Gorilla, he totally whiffed. it was terrible. The legends, I mean, we're going to keep talking about this tonight. They really jacked up this house show. I mean, Pedro back and it was crazy. He definitely looked out of sorts, though. And to me, that kind of definitely hurt the match, particularly for Terry Gibbs. But like you said, Terry Gibbs just takes a heel tactic and just beats it to death for, you know, again, this match was 12:15, so at least 7 minutes of heel moves that were being used over and over again.
Did he look out of sorts, though? Or, Parv, you probably watched more Pedro than Scott and I combined times three. Or is that how he always looks?
Well, here's the thing with Pedro, okay? You want to – I mean, because he's so legendary and because he's a former champion and stuff, you want to give him all the best will in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But seriously, at this point, I just hate the guy. He is, I mean, I wouldn't say he looks any different in this match from how he's looked for the entirety of 1980, 81, 82. He sucks. He, honest to God, is terrible. I mean, that Pedro Morales versus Dom Morocco feud over the IC belt is the worst. It's the dirt worst. It's made me hate Pedro Morales, and it's made me hate Dom Morocco. I never want to see either of them ever again. And, oh, he sucks. I mean, that you know when they were just laying in that chicken wing?
Yes.
That's every Pedro match ever from basically when he comes back for the IC run to the end. He's just awful. Oh. And then he wakes up in the finish. So I went dud because I'm just used to, oh, right, they're going to go to the finish now, so he's going to wake up a little bit. I mean, that's basically it. He sleeps through a match, and then he wakes up for literally the last minute or 30 seconds.
Well,
I hate him.
I'm glad I don't feel bad about just hating this match and watching it. But I had the same reaction, Barb. I'm like, what am I missing? You know, like, what am I? I was kind of glad you were on for this one because I was like, maybe I'll find out if there's something I'm missing that I'm supposed to be seeing with Pedro. But throughout the match, I'm like, I just.
Yeah, the reason I'm maybe a little bit thinking a little higher is I've been watching some of the prime times from 86 as part of our network adventure series. And there's a couple of Pedro matches they put on. There was one Pedro match they put on there. I forgot who he wrestled. It might have been our Mike Sharp or somebody like that. And I think to myself, you know, here's a guy who's a year older, and this match just seems to have more energy to it. It seems more exciting. He does the whole clapping thing. He's moving around more. He's getting some, you know, his strikes seem a little more. And this match, he just seems very lethargic. So I feel like, as much as, I mean, you're talking a Pedro Morales that's probably in his, I would assume, his mid-40s by this point, that it just took him some time, because I feel like even against more jobbers or maybe even a notch above jobber in 1986 and even in early 87 when we see him on other stuff, that his work picks up a little bit and he seems a little more energetic. I just feel like he's so lethargic and rusty here that he's a little bit better once he starts getting, you know, his feet under him again. So I don't know. I'm not saying this match is 5 stars. I'm just saying that I have a feeling, at least in a vacuum, watching Pedro Morales matches as you move through 85 and into 86, he's a little bit better than you see him here. That's all I'm saying.
This bleeds into the next match a little bit, but as the next match was starting, I couldn't help think about Pedro. Because, I mean, just spoiler alert, the next match has got Hulk Hogan in it, and he's over, okay? And I've just written in the notes here, can you imagine how Pedro Morales felt in 1985? Yesterday's news has been a warm-up act for the hottest ticket in town, taking punishment from Terry Gibbs. I mean, it must have sucked. It must have absolutely sucked.
Well, he's probably happy to have a fucking job.
Well, Parv, you want him to feel even worse. Forget Hogan. Think of the guy that's in the main event of our show, who was in the same era and still feels like a star, and Pedro feels like a leftover. You know what I mean? He was used for the same reason in the 70s, different nationality. One guy was boosting the Italians. The other guy's boosting the Puerto Ricans and Puerto Rican contingent. And the other guy, who we'll mention later, still feels like a gigantic star. And even Gorilla treats him like a bigger star. I don't say he disrespected Pedro, but it's more like, yeah, that's Pedro. Hey, Pedro's back. That's cool. Meanwhile, we talk about the guy coming up in the main event, and it's, oh, my God, you know what I'm saying? So even more than Hogan, I concur with your point, but I'm going to take it even a step further, that with a guy who is one of Pedro's contemporaries later on in the show is treated like a legend, and Pedro's treated like some guy who just – was down on his luck and needed a job.
That might have been what it was. I mean, he might have said, I want to wrestle, and okay, well, you're not fucking main eventing. Like, I mean, to compare it to Bruno is interesting, but it's also the fact that Bruno is, he's not active. You know what I mean? He's just doing these little spot shots. Whereas Pedro obviously wanted to be an active member of the roster. So anyway, I think that's the difference there, but.
Yeah, exactly.
We can move on.
So there you go. So Pedro Morales beats Terry Gibbs in 12:15, and it's not good. So I hate to say it, guys, and I never say – I hate saying anything bad about MSG house shows, but we're kind of 0-3 so far.
Yeah.
But the show definitely picks up because as Parv mentioned, our first of two title matches this evening of the three belts, of course, as mentioned earlier, the IC belt is 3,000 miles away in Oakland. We have the other two here in our building. The World Wrestling Federation Championship on the line, a rematch from last month. Your champion, Hulk Hogan, on what, day 453, as Mr. Sutton mentioned, taking on for the second consecutive month, Mr. Fuji's grand prize, the Magnificent Morocco.
Okay, like I said, it is our rematch from last month, and Morocco won that one by countout. Huge pop here for Hogan, as always, as he comes into Eye of the Tiger, decked out in white. Morocco jumps Hogan before the bell, kicks and punches away. Hogan fires back, and they trade a series of blows until Morocco tumbles outside. Hogan follows him out, cracks him with an elbow, and hits an atomic drop before choking away with his headband. Back inside, Hogan is super aggressive, unleashing headbutts before slamming Morocco and dropping an elbow. The match spills back outside, where Hogan continues to bring the heat until Morocco grabs a chair, jabs it into his gut. Hogan recovers and returns the favor, slamming the chair across Morocco's back and then using more headbutts. Morocco's bleeding from the head as Hogan punches him and rolls him back inside. Hogan meets him in the ring, rattles him with a back suplex, and the crowd is going wild. Hogan pitches Morocco back outside again and follows him out, hoists him up, and rams him into the ring post. Hogan suplexes Morocco back inside and then slams him and drops the leg, but Morocco gets his foot on the rope to break up the count, which the referee sees actually after the three count. As Hogan arrives argues with the referee, Mr. Fuji hands Morocco salt, and he throws it in Hogan's face for the blatant DQ. I thought this was super fun. It was a frantic brawl. Ends up being a squash, pretty much, but it allows Morocco to escape without being pinned and sets up another rematch. Hogan was manic and aggressive out there, stuff you don't usually see from him in this time period, unleashing all sorts of wild brawling offense, and watching him keep throwing Morocco outside so he could brutalize him was so different from a Hogan match, where anytime he could, he just threw him to the floor and beat the shit out of him. And the crowd was just bananas this whole time. I went 2.5, which I think this speaks to the fact that it was a brief squash and a brawl, but that's how hot it was, and that's how fun it was to watch. It was only 6 minutes, so I thought it was one of the best like sub-10-minute brawls that we've seen, especially in the WWF 80s. What do you think, Scott?
Your official time, 6:12. I gave it a 2. I loved it, but I didn't like it as much as the first match that they had in April. I love the continuity that, you know, great house show work, get people in the building, so let's have a rematch. I would have added a stipulation here.
That's coming.
No, I did. Well, said that stipulation, then I realized what happens later on, so we'll skip that. But you know, like an ODQ or something easy. When I thought the match was over after Hogan dropped the leg, when Fuji put Morocco's foot on the rope, I knew it didn't happen, but let's pretend as if it was this moment. I would have thought Hogan was losing the title when they put Morocco's foot on the rope after the leg drop, and then Fuji threw Morocco threw the salt, because the bell rang like a good 10 seconds after the throwing of the salt, so it didn't immediately happen. I thought, holy shit, Hogan's losing here. You know, like if I was thinking that in 1985, obviously we know it wouldn't, but if you were watching it live. I think you could have conceivably said, wow, I mean, is he going to lose here? I mean, because I would have thought he would have pinned him with the leg drop. I thought Morocco was great. I just like the way he works a match as a heel. He puts over power moves. His strikes sometimes are a little wonky, but I really enjoyed him here. I think he works well with Hogan. I think they have good chemistry. And
well, it's easy when you're just getting the shit kicked out of you. I mean, he doesn't do anything.
Yeah, in this one, it was a lot. Like, that's one reason why I think I like the April match better, because it was a lot better back and forth there than it was here. It's still a lot of fun. Crowd was nuclear. I miss Eye of the Tiger so much. I really do. I mean, look, we know what theme he would eventually get, and we love that one too. But I loved Eye of the Tiger. And the crowd was through the roof. But Morocco saves himself another day, though. We don't get a clean pin, which surprised me a little bit. But I thought he was fine. I thought he really took the beating good. I like seeing Hogan kind of – because you didn't see it a lot in these first couple of years of Hogan at the top, where he would wrestle kind of unhinged, not usually Hogan style, except on house shows. I think we're going to document that a lot, JR, as we continue on with the house show circuit in the mid to late 80s. Hogan wrestled a lot differently than he did than he would on TV, like TV, like Science Main Event or pay-per-views. House shows, I feel like he has a little more fun, because I feel like he wrestled completely unhinged here that you normally don't see in Hogan matches. So I gave it 2 stars myself. Parv, I kind of think I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, you know, I really liked it. I mean, Eye of the Tiger, amazing theme for Hulk. He's just on fire here, Hogan. Crowd's insane, electric heat. And that heat amplifies virtually everything that happens. Mm-hmm. And the action is so far beyond everything else we've seen on the card so far, like the level of violence and so on.
Yes.
Now, to Scott's point, I feel like if you watch Hogan in 84, again on the house shows, Philly, MSG, he is a lot more like this, mm-hmm. brawly and violent and a bit more unhinged.
I feel like this is even a step up, though.
But this felt, yeah, I agree. This felt even more so than normal. And I thought that was really something, actually, the level of just sheer violence from Hogan. You don't see it that often, even in this earlier period where he's a bit rawer than he would become. I also thought it was amazing to see Fuji foil the big leg drop with the foot on the ropes. Because I did a semi mark for that. And then the salt, of course, very devious. And I thought that this was very clever. You know, Morocco got to retain his heat. Technically, he didn't get pinned. Hogan got the visual pin. It was kind of perfect booking in a way. What is this, like the middle of the three MSG matches?
Yeah, so the second one. The first one, Morocco won by count out. And you could tell that, I like the booking, too, from a psychology standpoint, that Morocco couldn't have wrestled a worse match, just in a pure kayfabe standpoint, not from a, you know, reality standpoint. But for a kayfabe standpoint, you go into the match, you couldn't have wrestled the worst match, but you still escape, and you're still probably going to get out of the match because it was not a clean finish. So it's almost like, okay, let me get another crack at this. It can't possibly go worse for me than it did here, and I survived. So it's almost like he survived his worst. You know, it's like a football team that has a career worst game from a quarterback but somehow survived. So it's like he made it out the other side in the worst possible match you could ever have, and he gets to live for another day. So I kind of like the booking, like you said, Parv, of – you know, Hogan, the crowd is going nuts. Hogan's super aggressive because he's pissed about last month, and he's just pouring it on Morocco, and somehow Morocco escapes, adding even more fuel to the fire for next month.
Yeah, so I gave it 3 stars for all of that. It's also it's really fun that obviously Bruno's on the card later on, and like this is almost like a callback to what they used to do in the Vince Sr. Like, I bet you that first match was a bit longer, wasn't it? The count out one that you would.
Yeah, it was like it was like 13 minutes, I think.
Yeah, so it wasn't that much longer. Yeah, it wasn't that much longer.
But Bruno would typically do that. Like he'd have a longer match, and then he'd get like really annoyed at what happened, and so you then get this match, which Hogan just did here. So it's actually quite
13:35. Yeah, 13:35.
Quite traditionally booked in a way for MSG. So that's quite cool to see kind of Hogan play Bruno a little bit here.
Let me ask you this, Parv. We know that you're not the biggest Morocco fan, and that's why I like goofing with you and jabbing you about it. But in all seriousness, you rated this match higher than both of us did. And yeah. I mean, obviously I'm assuming you didn't give Hogan can't be given credit for all 3 stars. What things did you not like about Morocco normally that you didn't see here, or did you? And Hogan just countered it. Or what your thoughts specifically on Morocco's performance specifically in the match?
Well, the thing that Don Morocco usually does, which I hate, is that he'll get in the match, and Don Morocco is a great promo, okay, and he talks a great game. And they'll talk about, like, you know, there's a big feud and he's just given an electric promo and he comes in and he's got terrific heat and the beach bum chants and all of it. And then the bell rings and he goes and sits in a chin lock for literally 20 minutes.
Okay.
So that's the thing that Don Morocco didn't do in this match. That he usually does that I like.
Okay. Okay. All right. I'm looking forward. I'm curious when we get to the finale next month if he does that in the specific stip.
He's a lot better when he's kept sub 10 minutes, to be honest. It's when Morocco goes, like, he's so lazy as a worker. Like, you know, if he's ever booked in a match where, like this, where, like, all of his worst tendencies are kind of curbed, like, he can't possibly sit in a, you can't sit in a chin lock in a 6-minute match where chair shots are happening, you know? Mm-hmm. He's perfectly fine. Like, he's great in some of the Ricky Steamboat stuff that you guys will watch later on as well. It's just like, those Pedro Morales matches are so bad. It's just soured me on the guy, you know. But it's not just against Pedro. He did it against everybody.
I'm surprised. I gotta watch some, because I haven't watched a lot of older Morocco in a long time, and I can't even fathom that. And I'm not saying the guy's a work rate marvel. I'm not. I'm just saying I can't believe that, because I feel like he was so hot in like 81, 82. I just can't fathom his matches being that bad, but you know, I have to check it out. I have to watch some of Morocco.
It's amazing how bad he is. And the thing is that Morocco, when he's younger, if you ever see him, like, I've seen him in like Florida in 76 and stuff like that.
Yes,
like,
I have too. Yep, in AWA.
He's kind of like a Jack Briscoe protege type thing, and he's a lot more spry. Like, mm-hmm. he gets big, you know, Morocco, stacked and a little bit fat as well, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And with that extra weight, he gets lazy. I actually think it's because the guy is late. Like, that beach bum gimmick is like,
oh yeah,
basically really
him.
It's like you saw Putski's body in like the early 80s and said, I'm going to do this. So I'm going to have that big gut and be real muscled up. That's what he wanted to do.
Yes.
No, I agree. I think that's definitely his just real personality coming out. I mean, he's too easy with it. You know what I mean? It comes too easily. And, you know, whatever. I mean, it worked for him. And it got over. Yeah, I mean, this match, I'm with you. I was closer to a 3 than a 2. So I would, we don't do quarter stars, but it probably would have been, you know, 2 3/4 for me. I just thought Hogan, like you said, was... It was next level brawling for him. It was this anger he rarely taps into. And that's what made it so fun. And the crowd is just fucking rabid for him to just destroy Morocco. And yeah. He almost does. So, good match.
Yep. So, in 6-12, Hulk Hogan retains his World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship. But it is still inconclusive. And as we mentioned, there is a third match. And we'll get into details on that a little bit later on. Why don't we do one more before the break?
All right. We actually, before that match, though, Scott, we have a little shakeup in the commentary booth. Me and Gene has other duties to take care of. He's got duties to do. So he heads to the back to take care of those duties. And Lord Alfred Hayes, our old friend from TNT and WrestleMania 1, makes his way out. And he's giddy to be back in MSG and gushes over how great Gorilla Monsoon is as a commentator. So a lot of love here mutually between these two guys. And Alfred will carry us home as Gene heads to the back.
Thank God. I was about to say that. Yeah, I was very happy. I like Alfred on commentary, and I'll get more into it as we continue on. But I like Alfred and Gorilla together. I think they're even though Alfred is a babyface like Mean Gene is, he'll at least work on the analysis of the match, and he'll give heels credit where credit is due. Whereas Mean Gene was just so aggravating.
Well, Alfred
bad.
Would side with the heels a lot of the time too, right?
Yeah, he would. He would be a good counter to Gorilla, and they'd have a good good back and forth banter. Do you agree, Parv? That at least yeah. Your countryman there adds a little more balance to the table than with Gene there.
Well, I love the dynamic between Monsoon and Lordal because they're two old wrestlers, mm-hmm. and you can tell, like, especially in, how can I put this, like, quieter match. You know, there's so much downtime on some of these cards, mm-hmm. and it's when they start shooting the breeze a bit more. You know, I love it when they're actually just conversing with it, like. You can tell that this may actually be the sort of conversation they'd be having, even if they were calling the match type thing. I like it when that stuff comes in. And I'm probably the biggest proponent of the Lord Al Sean Mooney team that there is on earth. So,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
But on this particular appearance by Lord Al, I feel like this is the first time he came to MSG and called a match with Monsoon. And if so, it's the start of a beautiful friendship. So I don't know if anyone listening knows or if we can find out, but I want to say this is the first time Because I think this would be the team for a long time at MSG, wouldn't it? The Monsoon-Nordahl pairing. Mm-hmm. Monsoon did a lot of the house shows with Nordahl, like down the years.
Yes.
When you look at the listings and things. Yep. So if this is the first time, it's actually quite a momentous occasion.
Yeah, it is. JR, we might have found a new nickname for your son.
Lord Al.
Hey, you can say, Lord Al, come on, you're not sick anymore. Enough with Carl von Krupp.
I'm going to have him start listening to Letters from Kayfabe extensively so he can pick up the accent. And it'll be good to go.
There you go. All right. So as Lord Al gets into in the seat, we move on to our next match. The other half, although they're technically not a team yet, so I shouldn't say that. But we have another protege of the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, who, as mentioned, is probably 3,000 miles away in Oakland with his Intercontinental Champion, taking on the guy who has been the number two behind David Sammartino in the jacked up bubble butt department.
Yes.
And that is Mr. Quick Draw, Rick McGraw.
Yeah, he's got nothing. He's got nothing on the bubble butt of David.
No, that is true.
Not the apple butt.
But he's also like eighth in the jacked up list tonight.
I know, right?
He's getting out close.
He's going to turn it up.
He's going to turn up the cycles.
Bret Hart back this month. Gorilla informs us he's now officially in Jimmy Hart's stable. We open things up with a lockup and some posturing as Gorilla says Stu Hart's not happy with the way Bret behaves in the ring. Alfred talks about the dungeon, which he calls a torture chamber, where he destroys wrestlers. McGraw outworks Hart a bit early on and eventually slings him to the floor. Hart regroups and returns to the ring, but Quick Draw catches him with a wrist lock, and Hart works out of it and knocks McGraw to the floor. Hart keeps working over McGraw, and when he returns to the ring, eventually grabs a rear chin lock. Hart runs through some more stalking, precision offense, surviving a flash pin attempt by McGraw to maintain control. Hart would head up to the top, but McGraw popped up and met him with a big slam. Quick Draw hits a double knee lift and vertical suplex for two counts. Gorilla breaks down how important it is to hit a suplex properly, or you can do more damage to yourself than you do your opponent. Quick Draw charges Hart at Hart in the corner, but Hart catches him and drops him face first across the top turnbuckle, follows that up with an elbow off the middle rope for the win. This was solid enough, actually. I thought it was a good finishing sequence, which is, I thought, kind of been in the water here tonight. Some of these matches have been shaky, but I thought the finishes for all of them have been pretty good. Hart keeps rolling on and remains undefeated under Jimmy Hart's tutelage. I went 1.5 for this solid affair. Parv, yourself?
First thing, doesn't Bret look amazingly young at this point?
Oh, yeah. So baby-faced and...
Yeah, a little pudgy. Yeah.
Like, he doesn't even look like young Hart Foundation, but he's like almost Calgary Bret, this is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, most of my notes are about the commentary. I really liked Lord Al talking about the sadistical pleasure of
really
Stu Hart.
I like the line quickly, I don't know if you caught it. I like when Lord Al says, I read an article where Bret said the best shot is the cheap shot. It's like a great line. It was fantastic. Great Lord Al. It was fantastic. I loved it. It was great. So happy to see him next to Gorilla. I really was.
Monsoon, so sad that Bret has fallen under the influence of Jimmy Hart.
Yes.
Almost like a disappointed uncle or something.
Yes.
Heartbroken.
Yeah. I also really loved, this is some deep kayfabe here, Lord Al working the narrative of the young Bret looking up to the IC champion Greg Valentine and learning some of his style and, using him as a kind of wrestling role model. I thought this was some, like, great BS from Lord Al here.
Yes.
During this match.
And that is what makes these guys great. I mean, I thought it worked with Gene, too, is just how much they BS. But like you said, there's so much time to kill on these cards. That stuff like that, it helps enhance the characters and the stories. Like, that's a believable thing to say. I mean, okay, they're both the same stable. Valentine's a wily veteran. Bret's coming up. Of course he'd probably look up to him and try and take things on. Like, it's not so absurd that it's like you're rolling your eyes. It's like, okay, you know, that actually kind of makes sense. And like you said, it's just so detailed, the detail he goes into.
I've honestly come to the point in my wrestling fandom where I'd rather a Lord Al Gorilla Monsoon team than like Pete Jim Ross or something like that. Like, I'd much rather Gordon Soley is quite good at this. Gordon Soley is like a different, like, he'll go into like the strategy psychology, which is his own kind of BS in a way, which is quite cool. But I really love some of this. I can't think of many people I'd prefer to have on commentary than these guys on a card like this, you know, filling up the time took, you know, God knows what was happening during that part of the match, but it made it more enjoyable for me. I gave the match 2 stars, by the way.
I like that finish. What did you think of the finish, too? I thought he really slung him into that top turnbuckle hard, and then I like how he quickly just pelted him with the elbow and got the win.
Yeah, no, decent finish. I mean, it was good for what it was. It was perfectly fine. I mean, Rick McGraw's not bad. Like, this is kind of late on for him. Mm-hmm. But he has some pretty spirited performances, like, down the years. By this point, he must have been getting a bit frustrated because he'd been stuck at basically the same point in the card for half a decade by this point, and he's still like being talked about as a young up-and-comer.
he had
matches with like young pre-AWA Kurt Hennig and stuff like that. You know, like when Kurt Hennig has like a 1981 run.
Right.
Like Rick McGraw's like there still, and he hasn't moved one... Right. He hasn't moved at all in his career between those 2 points. So,
yeah. I gave this match 2 stars as well. I love the commentary with Gorilla and Lord Al about the dungeon and mentioning Stu and all that. And I agree with you, JR. I kind of like the whole thing with Gorilla sounding like, it's not how he raised his kids though. so upset. It was really funny. To me the whole show changed once Alfred got in the seat. It was really top notch. Rick McGraw is just kind of spinning his wheels here. The match was fine. It was what it was. But even now though, we talk about a young Brett, but he kind of knew his way around the ring. I wouldn't say he's a wily veteran or anything, but he knows more about handling a match than you would think someone that young could. And I think that's the experience of being in Calgary and having Stu as his dad and having all that experience around him when he was younger. He definitely is ahead of the curve than some of these other up and coming guys, you know?
It's the positions he was put into.
Yep.
At a young, like he was put straight into that main event scene in Calgary, wasn't he?
Yep. Exactly. So, all right, I believe our length officially was 8:31. So not a bad, good, solid length. I gave it 2 stars as well. So there you go. Bret Hart continues his ascent up the card with a win over a quick draw. All right, why don't we take a break? Parv, what do you think so far? Show seemed to get off to a kind of a sluggish start, but it's picked up the last few matches.
Yeah, I think once Lord Al hits the booth and Hogan lifts the crowd, it's more fun. The first three matches are just kind of par for the course for them. You know, I've seen so many of these bloody cards now that I don't care. I'm just immune to it. I'm like a, what's that thing? Stockholm syndrome or something. I'm just immune. It doesn't matter. Like, show me all the Morales matches in the world. I just tune into the commentary comments and perk up when anyone says anything interesting, you know?
I agree. The first three matches were awful. I mean, this is our fifth one or whatever. It was easily the worst of the cards we've seen so far from MSG. Those first three matches were really bad. Usually we've at least got like a star and a half sneak in there or something, but these three were pretty rough. Thankfully, Hogan came out, like you said, and really woke the crowd up.
I think Vince needs to put Rene Goulet out to pasture at this time. Like, I know he does. I know he doesn't, but like, he's bringing no worth at this point that I can see. Like, all his matches are the same. Like, just eating up 10 minutes, doing nothing. You know,
yeah, with a claw, three claw attempts.
Ugh.
You know, the match isn't going to be close to ending until at least he gets two and maybe the third in. He's a minimum of 2 claw attempts before the match can end.
Right. So, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we've got, 4 matches left, another championship match, and then, of course, the return of a living legend, whose last match in this building was one of the most memorable days in that building and one of the saddest days in music history. We'll get to that later on in the show. But first, many words, because...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Hey, this is Ed Banger Thrasher, and you're listening to Where... What the fuck is it? The Place to Be podcast, so you better not miss it, because I'm on it.
Place of a Nation, we are back here reviewing the May 1985 Madison Square Garden House Show, and I hope you didn't forget about us while we were gone, because, Scott, it is now time for our Pop Culture Corner, and if you heard the song playing us in from that break, it was, of course, Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, and I believe, Scott, that was the number one song in the nation on this week?
It was, 2 days before, of course. This is a Monday house show. So that's Saturday when the weekly Billboard Top 100 is released. They do the lists. And what's funny is, JR, this movie that it came from, The Breakfast Club, has been out for like 4 months at this point. Remember when we did the pop culture episode, segment on our February – on the War to Settle the Score, actually. That's when it came out. And so the movie's been out a while, but the big song from it as number one, which means our girl got bumped from the top spot. Crazy for You by Madonna dropped to number two. Another movie, another song from another movie. That was, of course, from Vision Quest. We always mention it. Number three, JR, our other good song there. One Night in Bangkok. You ever heard of Murray Head, Parv?
Murray Head.
You know the song One Night in Bangkok? Not One Night in China. That's another country.
One Night in Bangkok. No.
Okay. That's one of the big songs.
You're not missing
I do have a quick... I don't want to derail things too much here, but I have to ask you guys, if you had to say, at this point in history, who's a bigger star, Hulk Hogan or Molly Ringwald, who would you say?
Molly Ringwald.
Well, Scott was more pop culture conscious in 1985, so I think he's the best to answer this.
I mean, Molly Ringwald at this point, I mean, we've already had, let's think of what she's in at this point. Breakfast Club, I'm pretty sure Pretty in Pink was out already. She was already in, she already got kicked off of the first season of Facts of Life, so she's been on a lot of stuff by 1985, so you never know.
And now from the vantage point of 2017, who's a bigger star, Molly Ringwald or The Undertaker?
Well, that's a little different. There's no doubt about that. But anyway, One Night in Bangkok by Murray Head, number three. Our guy there, Mr. the late, great George Michael, and Wham at number four, moved up four spots from last week with Everything She Wants. Our Yacht Rock special, JR, moved up two spots, number five. Sade, a little smooth operator.
Oh, yeah.
Number six, staying exactly where it is, The Power Station, which, of course, as I mentioned, was Robert Palmer plus some guys from Duran Duran, and that was Some Like It Hot. Number seven, moving down three spots, A Little Rhythm of the Night by DeBarge. Number eight, moving down six spots. Wow. Former number one, and that was, of course, We Are the World, USA for Africa. Number nine, moving up one spot in the poll, is Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And at number 10, the third song in this top 10 from a movie, Axel F. by Harold Faltermeyer, which came from the, I believe by this point, I think it was Beverly Hills Cop 2 soundtrack.
Was Beverly Hills Cop 1985? Wow.
Yeah, I think this was the second one. I think the first one came out in 84. This might be...
That's a little bit earlier than I thought, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Wow. Yeah. No, this. I'm pretty sure this was the second one. I might be wrong. It's probably the first one. In fact, I'm almost sure it was the first one. But so there you go. There's your top 10 in the Billboard top 10 for the week of May 18th. 1985, and that came out 2 days before this house show. All right, because the following week was, I think, Memorial Day, we had no movies come out the previous Friday, but we had two come out on Wednesday, and one came out on Friday. Now, you want to talk about big money. Now, JR, you remember last house show, or even last month, or last week when we did the Science Main event, we had a couple of stinkers. Far from stinkers here. Three exceptional films. One of them, a special... There it is.
All right, we just need it. I'll play it going out of the show. So if anyone's hankering for it, you can hear it at the end of the episode.
There you go. And Aparv, one of them might be one you and I personally like because it's from a movie series that you and I are very fond of, I believe. All right, so we'll go in order. Mm-hmm. The first one, May 20th. So two movies came out May 22nd, that Wednesday, and then that following Friday, the 24th one came out as well. So on the I'll combine them together into one release. Number three made $40.8 million. Very well known movie from one of my favorite comedians, Richard Pryor, did Brewster's Millions.
Oh, nice! High quality movie.
Oh, tremendous movie. JR, do you remember a little background on this movie for those that may not know? Do you remember
the story?
You remember the story?
Of course I remember the story. The guy inherits
inherits
a lot of money, and at first it looks like it's just like $1 million, but if he complies with his uncle's, right? Uncle's or it was something weird, right? Was it his
It was a long-lost uncle, right. Something like that.
Yeah. He was pretty far down the chain, but he was like the only somehow surviving relative, and he can get $1 million up front or spend $30 million over the next 30 days to inherit $300 million. But he can't tell anyone. He can't just give it away. He can only give like 5% away. He can't gamble it away. And he can't have any assets at the end of the month. he can't show that he owns anything from it. So it's a real fun movie. He's a like low level rec league baseball player, and he, you know, buys a game with the Yankees, and then he runs for was a mayor he runs for or whatever, and
something like that. Yeah,
he doesn't want to win, and then he ends. So I mean, there's a lot of good stuff. John Candy's in it; he's really good too as his buddy.
Yep.
I recommend it. Parv, have you ever seen Brewster's Millions?
Yeah, and in fact, for board game enthusiasts, there's a really good board game based on this premise where you start off with loads of money and you have to lose it. I don't remember the damn name of it now. It's called...
That's pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll see if I can remember it, and I'll throw it out there.
Okay.
There's an older film based on a kind of analogous premise starring Gregory Peck called The Man with a Million. Have you seen this film? I'd recommend that one too, because the premise of that is that he's given like a £1 million note or something, or like he's given a million, but he's not allowed to spend a penny of it, and he has to see how long he can go, like just on the premise that he's a millionaire,
right?
And seeing what people can give him. That's a really fun film as well. Like he ends up like manipulating the stock market because if he's into something, everybody's into it type thing. So that's something I'd recommend. Yes, and Brewster's Millions is really fun. So, yeah.
Yes.
I can't believe they haven't tried to remake Brewster. They've remade every fucking movie from, like, the 80s and even in the 90s now. It seems like such an easy premise to recreate with – I mean, it will never be done with the way that, you know, Richard Pryor did it and John Candy and the rest of the crew. But I cannot believe they have not given this a go again.
I could easily see like Kevin Hart in the Richard Pryor role.
Yeah, right. I mean, just anyone, like any comedian. I can't believe they haven't given it a go. I mean, it's such a good story. It's such an easy story to tell. It's been whatever 30 years since it's been released. It seems like it's a easy enough story that they could recreate.
I agree.
In modern times,
the board game is called Last Will. By the way, that's one for Chad to check out. I know he plays in-depth board games like I do. So there we go.
Okay. Number two, this came out that Friday. Brewster's Millions came out that Wednesday, and there's one more movie that came out that Wednesday that made a shit ton of money. This was number two, and Parv, you and I particularly enjoy this one. It made $30 million domestically, $50,327,960 worldwide, and indeed it was the final James Bond film for Roger Moore, and that was, of course, A View to a Kill.
Starring Christopher Walken, right?
Yes. Early Christopher Walken, before he went crazy, and he was good in this going crazy. And Tanya Roberts, who was atrocious, and Grace Jones, and the first number one song. I'm surprised, and that may actually hit our billboards as we head the next couple of months. The theme song, which was played by Duran Duran, was the first Bond song to ever reach number one.
Really?
The story is, plot is, I'll help you on this one, JR. The plot is that Max Zorin, who is the bad guy in this movie, who originally, by the way, and I'm sure you know this, I said this on the music podcast, Parv, and I'm sure you know this. You know the original guy that Cubby Broccoli wanted to play Max Zorin?
Who was that?
David Bowie.
What? Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Doesn't it? But he had said, but apparently I read that he didn't want to have, he knew he couldn't do the stunts because, you know, Bowie weighed like 105 pounds. So he would have gotten killed, but he didn't want to have a double do it. So if he couldn't do his own stunts, he didn't want to do it. So you know what movie he ended up taking?
Labyrinth,
which of course
my
is
my favorite of all time.
Oh, it's a tremendous film. Absolutely great. I just watched it recently. Then Cubby, for some reason he wanted a music guy because then he asked Sting. And Sting said no, so then he just took Christopher Walken. Imagine being Christopher Walken is third on your list. Isn't that wild? That's the weirdest thing.
Sting did do a movie, though, and like a not very good one, I seem to recall.
Dune. Or are you thinking of another one?
No, I'm thinking of like some...
It was Shutter Speed, wasn't it? Was that a different Sting?
It wasn't the wrestling Sting.
He did do Dune, though, but I think Dune came out after this. A little bit after 1985. Anyway, Max Zorin is an industrialist. He was actually not a clone, but he was like bred by a doctor who worked with the Nazis. and he wanted to create his own microchip, and he wanted to corner the microchip industry, so he had a plan called Operation – oh, crap. What the hell was it called? Do you remember, Parv? What the heck was it called?
I don't know.
Something Strike. I don't remember. It wasn't Grand Slam. That's Goldfinger. What the hell was the other – crap. Anyway, he wanted to – he was going to blow up Silicon Valley, and then he would corner the world market on microchips. And Bond had to stop him and all that kind of jazz. So anyway, that was Roger Moore's last Bond, because by then he looked like shoe leather.
And now he's the cowboy and talks about sports here on
PlayStation. That's right. That's right. Yes.
Do you think Grace Jones could have had like a wrestling run? Because, you know, she seems like she – I don't know. There's something about her that seems a bit pro-wrestling to me, that she could have like fit in somehow into the –
I kind of agree with you, Parv. I feel like she would have been like a mid-80s version of Tyson, where she would have played ball, but she would have been slightly unpredictable. I don't know where she would have gone with it. Maybe she would have attached. She would have been a good heel. Like, she'd have been good with Piper, you know?
And yeah, no, that's exactly what I mean. Like, I don't know, like Piper bodyguard or something. Like, she seems to be like a role for her in wrestling somewhere.
Right. No, I agree with you. I think she would have fit perfectly in that role. So, and then 2 years later, of course, we had a new Bond in another movie. Anyway, that was number two. And the number one movie that week, which came out on Wednesday, the 22nd, $44 million domestically, $150,415,432. So this was a killer and one of the best sequels of the decade. Rambo, First Blood Part 2.
I thought it was going to be Sister Act 2.
No, that's about 6 years later. That would make $150.
How dare you?
But, the sequel to First Blood, I mean, it's Rambo. I mean, it's probably – obviously, it's Sly's number two guy behind, of course, our favorite guy, JR, Rocky Balboa. Yeah, tremendous film. And it made a boatload of money. So there's your number one film at the box office.
Do you hear Rambo talked about much these days? Like, I feel like it's talked about less than some of the other big 80s franchises. Am I wrong there? Well, there was like a recent film, it was a good like 7-8 years ago now, but
right.
Wasn't there like a new Rambo?
Didn't it come out, right, JR? Didn't it come out the same year Rocky Balboa did?
Yeah, I think he did both at the same time.
It had a niche, I think, Parv. It obviously doesn't have that same star power in terms of the character or the franchise that that Rocky did.
Well, I mean, Rambo's more... fun, right? I mean, not fun, but you know what I mean? Like Rocky was more, I mean, that was like Academy Award level filmmaking, right. At least the first first couple.
Right.
Then it became campy. But it was, you know, Rambo wasn't at that level. I mean, so it's hard to compare.
No.
You know, it's not really fair to compare. They weren't made for the same reasons.
Exactly. And, I mean, Rambo was just straight up 80s action film, kill the commies. You know,
but do you think like Rambo, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like Terminator, Predator, what are the other big films from around that time? Even like Die Hard from a bit later.
I think it's the actor. I think Sly was hot at that time. And I think, I mean, this is 85. Rocky IV was due out at, or did that come out in 87? No, that came out in 85.
Rocky V is 90. That's all I know.
You know, Rocky V was 90. Rocky IV was either 85 or 87. But I think it was 85. But I think Sly helped that, Parv. I mean, mm-hmm. Arnold was Arnold, but at the time, Arnold was the Terminator, even though he was in other stuff, Commando, Predator, you know, some other...
Conan, yeah.
And right. But Sly was Sly. I mean, he was at a different level than some of these other guys were. So... I think Rambo was kind of piggybacking Sly's success. But JR's right. Rambo was just an action movie niche thing. Rocky is Rocky. I mean, Rocky's iconic. But yeah, Rambo, I think, doesn't get the love it deserves. But it was a good series. But that also got campy. And then the storylines went out the window, and then it was just all about blowing up, you know, Chinese or, you know, evil communists or whatever it was. Then obviously the Rockies were, but so there's your three top movies that week that came out, all pretty good ones: Brewster's Millions, View to a Kill, and Rambo: First Blood Part 2. Let's hit some sports. On this day in Major League Baseball, it was a Monday, as mentioned. The Yankees had the day off. The Mets lost to the Padres 2-0. Actually, Dwight Gooden took the loss, and that was the year he won the Cy Young Award and only lost four games. That was only one of his four losses. Your division leaders at this moment, the Blue Jays lead the East with a record of 22-14, a half game ahead of the Orioles. The Yankees were 18-16, fourth place, three games out. The Angels led the West by a game over Minnesota. Mets led the East by a game over the Cubs. And the Padres led the West, the defending nationally champions, led the West by a game and a half over the Astros and the Reds. And quickly, off days in both the Stanley Cup and NBA playoffs. In the NBA, the two juggernauts were about to meet. The Lakers led the Nuggets 3-1 in the West, and the Celtics led the Sixers 3-1 in the East. The Stanley Cup playoffs, the Stanley Cup finals would begin the very next day. It would be the Wales Conference champion Philadelphia Flyers against the Campbell Conference champion and defending Stanley Cup champion Edmonton Oilers. That was Wayne Gretzky in his zenith. And finally, Parv, I wanted to kind of make you feel comfortable, so I'd asked you if there was anything that you wanted me to mention kind of in your on your side of the pond that was kind of a big sports thing that took place in 1985. And it was actually very sad day, one of the bigger tragedies. Make sure I pronounce this correctly. The Heisel, is that what it is?
Yeah, Heisel, yeah.
Heisel Stadium disaster. It occurred 9 days later than this. It was May 29th, 1985, when escaping fans, and this is not the last time this has happened, when escaping fans were pressed against a collapsing wall in the Heisel Stadium in Brussels, Belgium, before the start of the 1985 European Cup final between Juventus, is that how it's pronounced? I always never can get
yeah,
that right.
Juventus
of Italy and Liverpool of England. 39 people, mostly Italians and Juventus fans, were killed, and 600 were injured in the confrontation. Approximately an hour before the final was due to kick off, Liverpool supporters charged at Juventus fans and breached a fence that was separating them from a neutral area. This came after a period of hostility between the two sets of fans, which saw missiles thrown from both teams' supporters. The instigators of violence are still unknown, with varying accounts. Juventus fans ran back on the terraces and away from the threat into a concrete retaining wall. Fans already standing near the wall were crushed. Eventually, the wall collapsed. Many people climbed over to safety, but many others died or were badly injured. The game was played despite the disaster. Juventus won 1-0. The tragedy resulted in all English football clubs being placed under an indefinite ban by UEFA from all European competitions. It was lifted, 5 years later, not till 1991, with Liverpool being excluded for an additional 3 years and later reduced to one, and 14 Liverpool fans found guilty of manslaughter and each sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. The disaster was later described as the darkest hour in the history of the UEFA competitions. Didn't another one happen? And Axel Foley was investigating the incident. Did another one happen, Parv? I know ESPN did like a 30 for 30, like a European 30 for 30 on it. Didn't another one happen in the 90s? Didn't another?
There was. I think you're thinking of the Hillsborough.
Yes.
One. Yeah. Yep. That would happen too. But I think that one was more as a result of like safety and stuff like that. Whereas this one, this Heisel one, is much more connected to the kind of hooliganism that was going on in the mid 80s in football and like fan violence and things like that. So I guess there are different accents put on these two different disasters. So that later one is seen as like a failure of police safety and stuff like that. Whereas this one is seen as kind of like just a dark moment for football in general, because right. It could have been avoided if the fans hadn't done what they did.
Right. So, okay.
Yeah.
Right. So that happened. That would happen 9 days later on May 29th, 1985. And there we go. There is our pop culture update for the week of May 20th, 1985.
I felt like it took the whole year of 1985, but here we are.
So there you go. All right. Our next match, as we head back to the Garden, is our last match before the in-house intermission. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Diana Ball and other substances, another guy who you could, two guys who you could probably accuse of it. Meet here in the ring, JR. Who do we have?
Well, we have Tony Atlas taking on our old friend Ken Patera, and this is Patera's final MSG appearance for nearly 2 years. Hmm? So there you go. Patera back on the scene, been MIA on the big shows for a little bit of late, ever since the Andre stuff earlier in the year. Atlas is all jacked up as always, gets a warm reception. Alfred talks about how Patera doesn't get worked up out there because he burns cool and doesn't get into a rage. Patera and Heenan stall and get the crowd By the way, was that just like a rib on him because he threw the fucking thing through the window? I mean, it must be, right? Because he keeps saying it, that he doesn't lose his head and doesn't get filled with rage. He burns cool and stays calm in these situations.
Probably. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Patera and Heenan stall and get the crowd worked up as Gorilla discusses Heenan's bounty on Orndorff. Both men take turns posing until Patera charges Atlas, but Atlas catches him coming in and rattles him with right hands until Patera heads to the floor. Patera heads back in, is able to gain control and grab a chin lock, and that turns into a headlock. Atlas breaks free and gets a series of leapfrogs. He backdrops Patera and hooks a chin lock. Atlas gets distracted by Heenan and gets clobbered from behind and knocked to the floor. Patera follows out and runs Atlas into the edge of the apron. Back inside, Patera grabs a bear hug, but Atlas reverses into one of his own. Patera breaks free, but Atlas hits a crossbody and suplex for a pair near falls. Atlas hooks a sleeper, but Patera breaks it and then begs off as Atlas blocks a cheap shot and hits an atomic drop for two. Patera recovers with a knee lift for two, but Atlas comes back with a hot flurry of punches that knocks Patera to the floor. Atlas runs Patera into Heenan, but gets tied up with the brain, and that allows Patera to clobber him from behind and off the top rope for the win. I thought this started really sluggish, but got moving nicely a few minutes in. And I actually thought they cut a pretty solid pace for two power guys. There was a lot of back and forth. I liked the sneaky heel win by Patera just when all looked lost for him. And I thought this was really a perfectly fine veteran house show match to take us into the break. And I went 2 stars on this. Actually, after the first minute or so, where I was like, oh, God, another fucking blah fest. And it actually picked up. And for these two guys, I thought they paced it really well. What'd you think, Parf?
Well, this is a match that genuinely would have been a main event in any arena a couple of years back. I mean, Atlas was huge in Georgia, and Patera was a big star everywhere. So this is actually some pretty decent star power on the card here. I mean, I thought the match was nothing, to be honest. But I did think it was awesome that Gorilla Monsoon called back to Patera retiring. That's something I watched. We watch play out on Titans, that whole feud between Patera and Monsoon.
Yeah.
Just brilliant continuity that he still mentioned the fact that he stayed retired from that point.
Right.
Thought it was great.
What do you think, Scott?
I gave it a star. I didn't think it was as good as
I guess I was in a good mood that day. I probably overrated it a bit. I think it was more out of like being impressed that these guys actually worked that much of a pace when I thought it was just gonna be a lot of more rest hold and power move based.
Mm. Our time length 10:50, which was longer than I thought. But Tony Atlas was still kind of pretty hot as a upper mid card guy, and I mean it was a decent power match. It wasn't even that crazy. the crowd was going nuts. I'm actually kind of surprised Patera won. I thought Tony Atlas was going to win this match. That's really all I got to say. I mean it was all right. I wouldn't say it was anything stupendous, but
I kind of thought the writing was on the wall because when Rocky Johnson lost, I figured that Tony Atlas was going to lose. were those two not connected anymore at this point?
They haven't really referenced any connection. Rocky hasn't been on too much. He's only been on 2 shows, and Atlas as well. And we've watched TNTs with both guys, and they haven't really mentioned any kind of relationship. So
Atlas kind of hangs around a lot longer than you think he does.
Yeah.
Like he's still lingering, like even after this, isn't he? Like next year and things like that.
I think so.
One thing I always notice about Tony Atlas is that his kind of like he must have the biggest gap between the width of his chest and like his what do you call it, the pelvic, not pelvis, but you know what I mean, like his waist.
Right.
His waist is tiny and his chest is massive.
Yeah. He's triangular.
He's got like the perfect triangle shape. I always am really impressed with that whenever I see Tony Atlas. And he was really wiggling about trying to get out of that bear hug. So it was quite extensiated in this match.
You get to see all the angles of the triangle.
Yes.
Barb, what are your thoughts on Patera not having made it at WrestleMania 1? Because he's embroiled in the big Andre feud. He's a big part of the feud with Stud. And then he fights Andre in the January MSG show, and you just never really see him again. Like, it all of a sudden becomes Andre versus Stud. Even on TNT, on the house shows, you just he just vanishes. And then he's not even at WrestleMania 1 at all. Do you have any insight there, or do you, any thoughts on why he was left off?
WrestleMania 1's kind of a mystery in some ways, like some of the booking decisions. Some of the people who weren't on the card, some of the people who were. Correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, Tito versus Greg doesn't make it to WrestleMania 1 either, does it? That's not on that card.
Tito, yeah, we spent like an hour on that. Tito fights Executioner, Valentine fights JYD.
It's just like the whole booking of that show is a complete mystery to me. There's a lot of weird things with WrestleMania 1. So, yeah, it's weird. That's all I can say. Like, they had enough time to put, you know, Matt Bourne on the card, but Patera doesn't make it. It makes no sense at all, right, to be honest.
It's weird how, and, you know, we talked about this on the Mania 1 show. It's like, why? He didn't even need a match. Like, why not have him out with Stud? You know, like, he was such a big part of the feud, and then he just disappears. And is like, I don't know. He was there when they shaved his hair and everything else. And Andre beats the shit out of him in January, but he doesn't win it clean. It's just, the whole thing is odd that he wasn't at least involved in that match at Mania in some way.
I agree. Yeah, it was funny. We got into that a lot on that vault, and it still is bizarre. But I don't know. Maybe because it's about 4 months later. You mentioned JR. This is his last. This is Patera's last appearance at MSG. But this, I think, is I believe 4 months later. I think it's August is when he's officially sentenced to 2 years in prison for the McDonald's thing with Saito. So maybe there was a sentencing hearing in March, and maybe they just didn't want to say something about Patera, and then he doesn't show up and the whole thing's fucked up. Maybe they wanted to just avoid Patera for the moment just in case, and then it turned out there was
it could come at any time, you know, like, yeah, he's, they weren't sure, so they didn't want to hype him for the show, I guess. But
yeah, that's the only thing I could think of, to be honest with you, as to why he wouldn't be. You know, Parv, you understand what I'm saying? Because it's according to the math, reading his wiki today, according to the math, it said 16 months after the incident. And the incident was July of 84. I think it was July. Maybe it was April. 16 months after the incident is when he got sentenced. So I did the math, and it's like August of 85. So maybe there was something that's supposed to happen in March, and they didn't want to, maybe they didn't want to book him heavily on that show, and then, you know, because remember, this is 1985. This isn't like 2003 where Vince could just, you know, mess around with the card or do some storyline. I mean, maybe he could have, but that's just my assumption.
I think it was easier at this point. I don't think people gave a shit. I think he could have done whatever he wanted in 85.
Probably. Can I ask you guys, because you guys have done something that I've never done, but I've always thought in my mind, like, how different does WrestleMania 1 feel from a regular MSG show at this time to you guys? Like, how different does it, like, how much more special does it feel to you?
It is, it definitely felt special. It definitely did. And I think more because this time we saw all the build-up. Like, I had always seen it more as a vacuum show. I'd never seen it with all the build up and hype. And when you piece it together with the TNTs and the house shows, I'm not going to say it feels like it still feels like an MSG house show in many, many ways, but it's one where you're getting almost like this May card where you're getting like three or four big matches cresting onto one show. Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Because you still get some weird random shit throughout the card, but you get the tag title match, you get the women's title, Andre Stud, and then the main event. So like those four matches, it's like a super house show.
Right. The only reason I mentioned that is because, I just wonder if in Vince's thinking and in the general thinking of the company at that time, whether it was a big show, but at the end of the day, it was just like a big show as opposed to something that everybody on the card had to be on or something. Like, I just think they maybe weren't thinking in the same way. It'd be like looking back and saying like, well, why wasn't this guy on the Shea Stadium card? Do you know what I mean? It's like, Do you know what I'm saying there? Like, it was a big show, mm-hmm. but it was just like a mega show, as opposed to like what WrestleMania is now type thing.
Oh, maybe it's the building. I mean, it's at the Garden, sure, but I don't know. You had the celebrities. I think that kind of jazzed it up too. Yeah, I definitely think it was the branding. It wasn't just like, you know, you can get the cheesy MSG open and all that kind of jazz. It was, you know, you got like the, you know, Easy Lover cranking through the loudspeakers and, you know, or whatever. And the, so maybe at the time it felt different. But,
I'm just wondering, like, any of the, like, say, Tony Atlas is not on that card, for example, is he?
No.
Ken Patera is not on that card.
Morocco's not on that card.
There are loads of people not there. But do you think that those workers would have been, like, really gutted that they weren't on the card, or would they just think, like, oh, it's just another show type thing? It's a big one, but literally it's just
I don't think they were... I wouldn't think they were gutted at missing the show as much as probably missing the payday, because it was probably a pretty good one when you look at everything going on.
On the other side of that coin, and it's even said on the True Story WrestleMania DVD, even Hogan says it, a lot of guys wanted to make sure that they had jobs. So maybe some of them thought, you know what, if we're not on camera and then this thing flops and he's broke, that some of these other promotions, you know, Vern and all these guys will rehire us if, you know, things go bad. So maybe they were thinking that way too. Maybe they didn't really mind not being on because maybe they thought that if this thing bombed and Vince goes broke and this is back to being a dumpster, they can go to Minnesota or they can go to Charlotte or they can go to Memphis or whatever, you know. So that's entirely possible as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say. All right, well, we take the in-house intermission and Gorilla goes backstage, and JR, he has a myriad of interviews coming up here.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's actually Gene who conducts pretty much all of them.
Well, I said Gorilla passes to Gene, yes.
Right. So we have a Gene interviewing a new guy. We'll talk about him more in a moment. The missing link, him and his manager, Bobby Heenan. Gene says Heenan secured the link after Orndorff dumped him. Heenan says he isn't sure if he can even control this man, but everyone better watch out. His history will be made. Gene tries to talk to Link, but he just paces around behind them. Heenan says they'll have the last laugh and the new most devastating force in wrestling. Gene then chats with Jesse Ventura, who talks about being the new number one announcer in wrestling, but he says he's not retired, as he's good enough to do both things, and warns Tony Garea about their match tonight, as MSG will witness a return of the body. He says when you are from down under, that means you go down. And this match went down because we didn't see it as part of this show, the version we had, so we will not be talking about Jesse's win over Tony Garea. I thought they were going to close the show with this at first because I didn't realize it wasn't on the card. And I'm like, they really put this fucking thing last after San Martino? I was like shocked.
Right.
And then I realized we didn't have it. Gene chats with Brutus Beefcake and Johnny V about tonight's big match. They reveal that Beefcake is from San Francisco, and Johnny V rambles about the Giants. V calls Bruno an old man, and Beefcake says he should have stayed retired. Gene then chats with David and Bruno. Bruno talks about how excited he is to be back in the Garden and back in the ring. He says he and David were frustrated with everything that has happened, and they are now ready to show V and Beefcake what's up. Bruno says he respects Beefcake as an athlete, but they're confident they can win. David says it's a thrill to team with his dad, the greatest of all time. Then Louie Anderson, Dr. Jerry Graham hits the ring. He comes out, waves to the crowd, and he walks off.
I agree. Good grief.
My lord. Any thoughts on that? Any thoughts on those interviews?
Fat, wasn't he?
Oh,
fat,
huge, massive.
Wow. I mean, how big was he? He was like one of the, what are those twins called? Those, he was huge.
The ones that would sit on the motorcycles?
Yeah. You know the ones I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Fat guy on the motorcycle.
Wow.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was. Yeah. Wow.
Fucking huge.
Like big enough that Monsoon and Lord Al had to mention it.
Right.
Afterwards.
He has enjoyed retirement. So, yeah, either of you have any thoughts on the interviews?
I did like the Bobby interview with Missing Link. I kind of liked how he walked. One thing about Missing Link, and we'll get more into it when we get to the match, just him walking behind the two of them, and he just had that look. He'd stop, kind of look at the camera, then he'd do the weird face, but he'd keep, like, stalking behind him, and he obviously was using this gimmick in other territories, and you'll get into that in a minute. But he kind of knew what to do on the camera, and I liked it. I thought it was a cool, thought it was a good interview by Bobby to kind of set him up.
What do you think, Parv?
Yeah, those were pretty standard.
Any comments on the interviews at all?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed Ventura calling himself the number one announcer because he wasn't wrong. He absolutely was the number one announcer. I also liked seeing Bruno back on the mic again, and I liked the fact that his son basically tried to like ape, like clearly like awful, terrible, like bad promo. I could cut a better promo than that. So yeah, very poor David Sammartino on the mic. Also think it's interesting that like this Beefcake Johnny V pairing here. What are those guys doing here? Like, what's the deal with Beefcake? Is he Beefcake like not in a tag team at this point?
No, he hadn't been. He had debuted and was at first kind of just presented as a quiet, I don't want to say kind of weirdo, but he was from parts unknown. That's why they make a big deal out of saying he's from San Francisco here. And over the last couple weeks on TNT and here, he starts to showcase a little more personality, and he's almost like a playboy. Like, he's a like kind of a new wave party guy. He's got like the studded out and the weird gear and the look. You know, he's meant to be like, I think, like a club goer with Johnny V. He's been teaming with Valentine, not officially as the Dream Team, just kind of a two guys teaming up, but it happened a lot. Like, they were regulars on the house show circuit as a tag team with Johnny V and Jimmy Hart managing them both.
Interesting. Okay.
Mm. Yep. Yeah.
I was also interested to see like what happened with Jesse and Gurria. Obviously, Jesse went over. But did you guys know when Jesse Ventura's last match was? Because this is really surprising to me.
It's 86 sometime, right?
Yeah, well, technically, his last singles match is against Tito Santana, 22nd of March, 86. But in 1990, he had a match.
Oh, tagging I do know with this.
Tagging with Roddy Piper against the Orient Express in L.A. in a house show.
Well, that was actually filmed. That was for the pilot they did for that show, Tag Team, where they were cops. They filmed that match specifically so they'd have B-roll footage for that.
Amazing. That's amazing. I just couldn't believe, like, why did he have this match in 1990?
Do you remember WrestleMania 6 when he says, like, that's my tag team partner, Monsoon? When Piper comes out, that's what he's referencing, that they had this show called Tag Team. I think they did the pilot and that was it. But that match is the footage. They're wrestlers turned cops or something like that. So
that's incredible.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
That's what it was.
Learn something new every day.
There you go.
But I think 86, Parv is like his last everyday match, that IC title match, because he kind of steps in for somebody. But sometime in 84 was the last match as a worker before he was actually told about the, you know, the blood clots and stuff.
Right. So he's just kind of like the announcer still in the ring.
He's like a card filler. Yeah. He's a card filler is what he is, really. He can do, I'm sure his doctors told him, you could do one match every once in a while, but the grind, you can't do the grind anymore. So I think his last actual match as a regular competitor was probably sometime in mid to late 84, I would think. And then by 85, from the next few years, he would do, you know, the next couple of years, he'd do one here, one there. But,
well, that's no great loss. I mean, everything he was as an announcer, he wasn't as a worker, basically.
No, not at all. No, I mean, him and Adonis were an awesome tag team in AWA, but yeah, by this point, there was more than enough talent in the company. He was happy just being an announcer. So
yeah.
All right, so we begin the second half out of the intermission in our second title match of the evening, JR, one of the hottest feuds, and this really has been a hot feud. The World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, the Foreign Legion.
Yes.
the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff taking on our number one contenders, the blistering hot U.S. Express.
And we've seen a lot of permeations of this feud since WrestleMania when Volkoff and Sheik won the titles. We saw them in April. They had those split matches, a really fun Sheik and Rotundo match, and then a Wyndham-Volkoff match. And then at Saturday's main event, they were on opposite sides of a six-man tag match. Mm-hmm. And now here we go. A big tag team title rematch. Good spot on the card, too.
Great heat for Volkov, singing as usual. That turns into a big pot for Born in the USA. Lou Albano leads the challengers out, and they look locked in and ready to go. Rotundo and Sheik kick things off with a mini rematch of last month. After some posturing, Rotundo out-hustles Sheik, frustrating him with a flurry before slamming him and tagging Wyndham. Barry comes in with right hands and then tags out as the challengers do a double-team wishbone. Sheik begs off, but Rotundo lays into him. He's bringing the heat before hooking a front face lock into a chin lock. Sheik breaks free, and both men tag out to reset the match, but the challengers keep control as Wyndham keeps bringing the fight to Nikolai. Challengers quick tag and take turns working the arm, but the tide turns when Nikolai dodges a dropkick, causing Wyndham to crash hard to the mat. Nikolai starts to unleash and power strike and then tag Sheik to continue the work. The champs bait Rotundo in to distract the ref and then unleash a quick double team as the crowd gets fired up. Sheik goes to an abdominal stretch, but Wyndham escapes and then reverses a vertical suplex before making a hot tag. Rotundo cleans house, but the numbers catch up to him, but a distraction allows Wyndham to ram Sheik into the buckle, causing him to fall outside and get busted open. Sheik rolls back in just as Rotundo tags in Wyndham, and the crowd explodes as Wyndham is pummeling Sheik and drops him with a bulldog, but Volkov breaks up the cover. They start to brawl and tumble to the floor where they continue to fight, including Rotundo cracking Blassie. The brawl keeps rolling on, but the challengers are barely able to roll in the ring to beat the count, giving them the win but not the titles. Another solid match with these guys, capped by a red-hot finish and a big-time gusher by Sheik. And it looks like this feud will continue, Scott, because the Express wins the bout and will still be lined up as top contenders. I went 2.5 stars on this one. I was hoping for just a little bit more, and the finish was red-hot, but I thought it was pretty rock-solid between the four men.
Yeah, I gave this, and our official time was 11:21. I gave this 2.5 stars as well. A lot of fun. Just like with Eye of the Tiger, love seeing Born in the USA blasted everywhere. Yeah, I mean, this was really fun. And these guys, these teams have incredible chemistry, working so much over these last, like, 4 months or whatever, that they're locked in. Sheik is a beast. I mean, Sheik's an absolute beast. I'm curious your thoughts on him in a minute, Parv, in this stretch. Sheik's just an animal. I mean, he gets it. And I mean, Nikolai's good too, but he's the power guy. Like, he's the power guy in the group, whereas obviously Sheik is the worker. Same thing with US Express. I mean, Rotundo's just locked in as the alpha dog in that team in terms of work. I mean, they went crazy. The ending was kind of a bummer. I felt like it was a little flat, but I understood why they did it. Again, I gave it 2.5 stars because it was really good. Two questions for you, Parv. First, your thoughts on the match. And secondly, your thoughts on Sheik at this point. I mean, he's a machine, in my opinion. Not just the working part, but just the psychology and the crowd and just working to get, you know, working with Nikolai against these guys. I mean, he's like I think he was the alpha dog of these, even of these four in this feud. So what do you think?
Yeah, well, I thought this was a pretty good match. I actually gave it 3.5. I thought it was a really good match. For what it was. I thought you guys were a bit stingy on it. Had great heat, great psychology. I mean, you know, if this match was on Raw or something, I reckon people would be going wild about it just because of how hot the crowd was, you know?
Right.
I thought they had great chemistry. Rotundo is much underrated, I think. I mean, obviously people know I'm an IRS fan and all this sort of thing, but I thought, like, he gets a lot of flack in internet circles that I move in, Rotundo. And I think he's super underrated, especially in this stretch for the US Express. He's pretty good, you know, in 85. Wyndham's always a great worker, of course. And Sheiky Baby, he could still go, as you've just been talking about. I mean, the thing about Iron Sheik is that he was a suplex machine. Like, he used to bust out all the different throws for fun back before everybody did that sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm all over this. I thought it was great. I'm wondering if I could talk you guys up to go to three stars rather than 2.5.
You probably could. I don't know if it was the mood I was in watching the show, or if I was like expecting, like I was so hyped for it, the way they built it up. And I think what soured me, or I don't say soured me, but put me in this mindset, Parv, was, have you seen the Rotundo Iron Sheik match, the singles match from April?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Not the singles
check
match.
Check it out.
You should check it out because it's really, really good. And I don't know. I think that was so good that it almost ruined this for me. Again, this is one where I'm probably closer to like 2 3/4, like closer to 3 than I am.
Me too.
2.5, but not quite there. But yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I could be talked up to 3 stars. I mean, it was really good, and the crowd was super into it.
I mean, yeah. I think Iron Sheik is a guy who's become kind of like super underrated as well these days, because everybody's first association with him now is those bloody shoot interviews he did, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Him as a you know, mental deficient, basically. You know, coke addict. No, but it really, I mean, that's what he is. He's a clown. I mean, that's what everyone looks at him as now, as a clown. But you forget how good he was at that stretch.
And then he, like, he had the massive guts, and he had the Colonel Mustafa run, and terrible, and WCW, and all of that sort of stuff. But, like, up until about, I'd say, 86, maybe even 87, he was still pretty good, you know.
I'd give you 87, because even that match at WrestleMania 3 with them against the Bees is, like, pretty underrated. And, like, he's still chugging along. He doesn't have the gut yet. So I would say I think it's when he gets fired for the drugs in 87 is when it goes downhill for him.
Absolutely, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, and talk about, like, throughout his career, he had really good heat. Really good heat. Mm-hmm. As great as Hussein Arab in 79, we saw him have some really good matches. The Sergeant Slaughter stuff is legendary, and this is a pretty underrated feud, you know, this one that we're
Agreed.
Looking at here.
I really enjoyed it. And I love how they've really done the permeations, like we said, since, you know, leading. We saw the TNT build, which is pretty good. Blassie was awesome, pumping it up on TNT. And then the Mania match, of course, the big upset. And then, like we said, those singles matches, the six-man at Saturday's main event. And then this, it's been really, really tight all through. One of my favorite feuds that we've watched unfold since we started this 85 story.
Have you got any Blassie promos? Because I love Blassie.
Just through the TNTs that he's been on, which were a couple.
Yeah. And then the one after Mania where, Kane, I got no Kane! that's a great promo, too. Yeah, I was surprised we didn't see any Blassie during the intermission. That would have been great. He would have added a lot to this. Then you get a Blassie promo with the Foreign Legion, which would have been a great mid-90s name for these guys.
Yeah, they're not sending. They've stopped sending the managers back, haven't they? At MSG.
Right.
Here.
Yeah, they've been out here. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Carry on. Yep.
So the Sheiky Baby and Nikolai lose the match, but retain their tag team championships. I almost thought they were going to win this night, but alas, not. And the feud continues. US Express still the top babyface team in the company. All right, next up, a special bonus match, as Fink would say before the show. And that is a guy that we just saw, JR, in the interview segment, taking on one of our favorite JTTSs. What do we got here?
The missing link, sir, Byron James John Robertson. Robertson began wrestling his career in 1960s in Canada. He was in his early 20s, initially wrestled under the name Dewey Robertson, and was a popular babyface in the Toronto area. His first wrestling title was in May 1973, teamed with the legendary Dennis Stamp to win the Tri-State Tag Team titles. He continued to have success in the tag division in the early 80s, but was also started a career in a singles career when he moved to Jim Crockett Promotions in 79, being managed by Buddy Rogers. He'd win the NWA Canadian Heavyweight title, which was vacant at the time, and even considered for the NWA World Heavyweight title for a bit. The main reason this did not happen was there were concerns about his drinking habits. From 1980 through 83, he spent a lot of time in Central States, where he won the majority of his titles of his career. In 83, he'd make the move to Mid-South, where this would be his new persona to start to take shape. Became Max the Missing Link, a character who looked and acted bizarre. The character developed when he moved to Texas and went to World Class as part of Skandor Akbar's Devastation, Inc. He would drop Max from his name and just started going by the Missing Link for his character. In 1985, April, Missing Link had a full-page photo appearance, Sports Illustrated. SI had Hogan on the cover and did a report on McMahon's strategy to take the company national. 1 month later, here he is in MSG, making his debut. His stint would be a short one, leaving in the Federation in October of 85 due to drug issues. Bounced around World Class, UWF, WWC in Puerto Rico during the late 80s before retiring in the 90s. Did some independent work from 04 to 07 before passing away on August 26th, 07 after a battle with lung cancer. Before we get to the match, Parv, any thoughts on Dewey Robertson / Missing Link?
None at all.
Was there more to his career than you knew? There was for me.
Yeah, a lot more. Yeah, in fact, he's kind of a mysterious figure to me. You know,
yeah.
Like don't really know a lot about him, and this run isn't really talked about a lot. I've only got one note on the entire match, so I might as well read it to you now. It just says, "Did Missing Link get an action figure?" Because when I see SD Jones in 1985, that's all I can think about is that he got an action figure. So
Hawaiian shirt.
Do we know if Missing Link got one?
I don't believe so. Did he have an LJN, Scott? I don't think so.
I don't think so. Oh, you mean the rubber figures? No, yeah. He didn't. Okay. No, he didn't.
No, he definitely didn't have one after that. So.
No, he didn't have one of the rubber guys, the big rubber guys.
All right, so Fink announces this is the special bonus match. Our old pal SD Jones in his Phillies colored gear set to square off with the Missing Link. Bobby Heenan comes out first, demands to make a special announcement where he issues a warning to every wrestler in the world to take note of the newest member of his family, the Missing Link, who's here to collect the bounty on Paul Orndorff. Link doesn't emerge after the announcement, so Heenan has to go to the back and fetches him. Gorilla and Alfred are in shock of this weird monster. Alfred says his neck must be 22 inches, and Gorilla guesses that he's 280 pounds. Of course, his favorite, guess the weight. Link attacks Jones off the bell, hammers away while also stalking around like a madman. Link drops a knee as Gorilla says his moves are out of the Neanderthal age. Link just keeps clubbing away as Alfred wonders how Heenan even found a guy like this. Link drops Jones with a power slam and finishes him with a quick headbutt off the top rope. Nothing much here, just a squash to debut Link. Uses basic strikes from various positions, nothing else. Link stomps around with a chair after Bobby tries to corral him. I thought it was an interesting heel debut, but Scott, I thought it was a weird fit with Heenan. Didn't this seem like a guy that would fit with Fuji? And I went dud on the match.
I did a dud, too. It was a glorified squash. I have 2 points. Bobby doesn't seem like trying to control him and everything. This is definitely somebody I could see Fuji finding in, like, some weird... Lord Al said Borneo or something, like a little weird out-of-the-way country. I definitely would have fit this guy with Fuji. I wouldn't have put him with Bobby. Bobby had enough guys. Bobby had Stud and Bundy, and those guys more fit.
I mean, I guess it makes sense, I guess. Bobby. And I mean, if you want to say he's there for the bounty... That's fine, but it's just weird seeing Bobby with like a odd miscreant like this. What did you think of that part of it, Barf?
I mean, I just feel like the whole deal is out of date in a way. Mm-hmm. Feels like it's like wrong era for this.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like the whole Missing Link, it just feels more. I don't know, so it shouldn't be. It's more like territorial, like late '70s. Just feels wrong. For WWF at this time, and I think possibly that's why it didn't make it. You know, like how long does this? This is short lived, right? It doesn't go on for
October. He gets popped for drugs and he's out. Drug problem.
Yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't feel right to me. I mean, I guess George Steele was knocking around still, wasn't he? I've never been one for these types of gimmicks. You know, mm-hmm. like the kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Just never liked them. So
right. Yeah, I didn't think much of it either. I mean, be honest with you, I actually kind of felt bad for SD. Yeah, you could have given. It wasn't Mario Mancini in the building or some other hack or something. You know, Paul Christie or one of those really bad low level.
That's what SD's here for. He's here for this.
No, SD's to put guys over, but not to get beaten. I mean, I know he did it to Bundy, but that was WrestleMania. But to lose to this guy in like 12 seconds.
Yeah, they're pushing him as a major guy. He's feuding with Paul Orndorff, maybe. I think they had big things in mind at first. I mean, they keep saying he's there to collect the bounty. I mean, he didn't keep saying that.
That's true, I guess. That's true. And I'd say so. He gave
a Paul Christie shout out.
Oh, you tell me? Like, I got all the jobbers in my head. Brian McKnee. I got jobbers all over my head, Parv. Let me tell you. All the guys I used to watch back in the day. But I mean, the one thing I got out of this.
What was his name? What? McKnee?
Brian McKnee.
And then Ivan Putski is Ivan Backney, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of Backney on this night, let me tell you.
By the way, the weight thing is so weird because Vince, he does it on TNT constantly too. Like, oh, man, how much did you weigh back in the day? You know, like, and like Gorilla here, they're so obsessed with the fucking weights. It's like, you know, and it's not a fat shaming way. It's just odd. They're obsessed with it. Oh, 280 pounds. Like, it's such a big part of their vernacular at this time period.
Right. I agree. Definitely. And he does it for everybody. Yeah. The guys that are in shape, they don't say like, oh, Gorilla, how much do you think he weighs? Oh, about 700 pounds.
No, like, I know. No. They're like obsessed with it though. They're like, oh, he checked into 270 pounds. Tipping the scales.
Tipping the scales.
Yeah, but I mean, Missing Link was ripped too. I mean, he might have been cycling on something, but I forgot how like great shape he was in. But yeah, the main thing I get away from this, and it kind of goes with what Parv was saying, it did seem out of sorts for WWF, but at the same time, I wasn't surprised. But he definitely didn't seem like a guy Bobby would have been with. This definitely would have been a Fuji kind of guy, like a missing, mysterious guy with, you know.
He's actually exactly the sort of guy that Blassie used to manage.
Right.
Back in the day, like Blassie would tend to have the more kind of uncontrollable types.
Like Baron Mikhelski Kluna or what's his name? Who's the crazy?
I feel like he had more of the like Bruiser Brody, Stan Hatt, like
see Greek guy, Greek guy, not Spiros Arion, the other guy. Was it Spiros Arion? Maybe it was.
That
was
Spiros Arion. Yeah, the Golden Greek Spiros Arion.
Yeah, there was another guy I thought that had like crazy hair. He was like on those 70s. I think he was on some of those early adventures, JR. Some of those early...
Crazy Luke Graham.
Yeah, maybe. There was another guy I thought too, but anyway. This is a pretty easy squash. Nothing crazy. And he gets the win and, you know, let me see what the official... What was Graham's official time? 1:55. Wow, it didn't even seem that long. And by the way, the Jesse Tony Garea match was 10:31. Well, gave him a decent amount of time. All right, before we get to the main event,
it was all an arm. It was all a bear hug. I guarantee you.
Bear hug and talking to the and posturing in his nice pink and sequin tights. Yeah. Speaking of the LJN figures. That was the one, because I had him. I had like 12 of them, I think. He was the one that I never really used, like when we used to, my cousins and I and my brother, we'd like actually have matches and stuff. One that I didn't use because he had these awesome blue boots and this crazy, these cool like pink tights. And if you use the guys long enough, all the paint would come off. Like my Piper guy, I used him all the time, so the hot rod shirt totally came off. So I never used the Jesse figure. So I kind of – life imitated art. He never wrestled for me. He did occasional matches, but I didn't want to lose all the paint off his tights. And he had these pink tights.
I'm surprised I gave Jesse a figure, actually.
I was surprised, too. I was surprised they gave him a figure in wrestling trunks. I thought they would give him one, like, with a microphone and that, because they did a Mean Gene.
Oh, there was a Mean Gene. Okay.
That was interesting. They never did a Gorilla.
There wasn't a Vince, though, was there?
No, there was no Vince. Nah, the problem with the LJN figures was you couldn't really do anything with them, really. Like, Hogan was the only one that, like, it was in an action pose. And the only one that had more than one, because they made them through 87, they did three Andres. They did one Andre where he had babyface blue tights with long hair. Then they did babyface Andre blue tights, Heenan family haircut. And then they did a heel one with the black singlet with the stripe, with the strap. The other good one, Greg Valentine had a cool one. I had the Bulldogs. Savage was a good one. But anyway, they were good. They were good figures. So anyway, those were the LJN figures. All right. Before we get to the main event, Fink comes out to quickly announce our next house show, which is, Friday. It's a Friday, actually, not even a Monday, June 21st. Quick card set up here, and of course you'll hear it on our next Place B podcast. Barry O to take on B. Brian Blair. Tony Garea against King Kong Bundy. Greg the Hammer Valentine will defend the Intercontinental Championship against Ricky Steamboat. Very cool. In a six-man tag, Ken Patera, Big John Studd, and Bobby Heenan will take on Barry Windham, Mike Rotundo, and George the Animal Steel. And then finally, the final match of the trifecta, we will have a return match. Hulk Hogan will defend the World Wrestling Federation heavyweight title against Magnificent Morocco in a steel cage. So look forward to that on Friday, June 21st. All right, let's get to our main event. A lot of history here, dating back to WrestleMania, and it kind of percolated since. What do we got, JR?
Well, we do have Bruno Sammartino's first match in Madison Square Garden in 4.5 years, April 21st, 1980, when he defeated Larry Zbyszko via countout. So that was Bruno's last match here in the Garden. And yeah, very well-hyped, well-built matchup between Brutus Beefcake and Luscious Johnny V, taking on Bruno Sammartino and his son David.
Ready,
bootylicious one, David Sammartino, looking a little slimmed down maybe here tonight. Maybe not. Bruno's looking slimmed down, though. He's looking great. Gorilla notes that it's been, he says, 5 years. A little off, Gorilla. Arnold Scotland is at ringside, forever Bruno's manager. I thought that was a nice little touch. Bruno and Johnny V start things off as Bruno clobbers him and whacks his Beefcake 2, sending them scurrying to the floor. Johnny heads back in the ring, gets taken down by David, who starts to work the arm. Johnny V gets a slam in, but David pops up and slams him in return, and then he goes back to the arm. V finally escapes and tags in Beefcake, but David grabs his arm as well. Alfred notes how similar the Sammartinos are in the ring, and David tags in Bruno, who keeps the pressure on, breaking out the old hammerlock twist. When David then comes in and uses as well, Beefcake fights up and tags in Johnny, but he is met by Bruno, mauling him with punches. David comes in and unleashes a flurry of right hands as well, but Johnny V survives, is able to turn the momentum. Beefcake lands a few shots in on David from the floor and tags in and goes to work, drilling David with a pair of backbreakers. Beefer and V trade off on offense, but Johnny eventually whiffs on a running knee to the corner and gets rolled up by David for the flash pin. Beefcake knocks David to the floor after the bell, and him and V work over Bruno. They work over Bruno and then take off. This was fine, some fine nostalgia to, but in many ways felt to me like a waste of Bruno, especially the way it ended. I mean, it could be setting up more matches, but I thought it was really shocking they didn't let Bruno get the hot tag, and if not get the win, if you wanted David to get the pin, at least set up the pin. He just kind of tags out, and then David gets this flash pinfall on fucking, you know, Johnny V. Like, he couldn't, like, hit a hot flurry and let Bruno tap him out or something. I don't know. There had to be something they could have done and not have to do it this way, where it's almost like they stole the win. Like, to me, the Sammartinos, this is an easy match with Johnny V out there to just have them dominate and pin him versus sneaking out the win. To me, that just felt like just a weird usage of everyone. I did think it was smart for V to take the pin instead of Beefcake. I thought Beefcake actually looked pretty good. He was well protected. David actually looked sharp here, too. I thought it was one of the best instances we've seen him. He obviously loved working with his dad, and MSG still loves DeBrune. So I went 2 stars here. I was expecting more, and I really hated the finish. I just thought it was kind of a stupid way to end it when you had Bruno, locking up a bear hog on Johnny V or something, or the backbreaker and making him submit. What did you think of this one, Parv? Did it meet your hype?
Well, I did love seeing Bruno, and I loved the moment. I thought it was cool. I couldn't believe Arnold Scarlin was still knocking around. Still, I mean,
I don't think he really was, right? I think he just comes out for this. Like, he was working backstage, I think.
It's just like, Scarlin. I mean, talk about people who got paid to do nothing. Anyway, Bruno's still over as hell. I thought the standing ovation was cool. I absolutely loved Monsoon and Hayes, remembering how Bruno did the hammerlock on them, like when they had matches with him. That was an awesome moment, I thought, where it was like two old guys reminiscing about their matches in the ring. Loved Bruno in the match. David Sammartino sucks in every single way. I actually thought Johnny V had a lot of time in the ring, considering. And then I saw that Brutus Beefcake was his partner, and probably like a stupidly green Brutus Beefcake at that. So it kind of made sense for Johnny V to be in the ring for as much as he was. But Brutai actually looked weirdly better than he would 6-7 years later.
He's not, like, he hasn't been awful in some of these early goings. Like, he's green, but he stays within, like, himself. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't try to do more than he can. And I'm curious to see how he grows with the Dream Team.
He's almost like the, what was that film where the guy, like, ages backwards or whatever?
Benjamin Button, yeah.
He's almost like he genuinely gets worse, and like he starts like being okay, and then he gets worse and worse. Loved the Bruno stuff, and I kind of agree. But then the only reason he was in these matches was to get his son over, right? So
right. Well, I'm okay if David gets the pin, but let Bruno come in and. I don't know, maybe they runs up. He's just like standing there on the apron, and David doesn't even look strong. He just dodges a running kick and rolls him up. Like, it's not like he was there to get David over and David like wins the match looking great. I mean, he barely barely beats Johnny fucking V. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's just, they go through all this trouble. They've built this thing for 2 months. They bring out Bruno out of mothballs, and then they roll out there, and this is the freaking finish they come up with on a night when there's been a lot of good finishes. It's just, the whole thing was odd to me. What'd you think, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, the ending didn't do David any favors whatsoever. I mean, it made him look like a schmuck. And Bruno, or if Valley Brutus hardly did any work, I agree with you on that completely.
It is, the match never felt like a good going. It just like,
no, it really didn't. It really didn't. Having said that, this should have been the match at WrestleMania. I mean, we had this discussion already, but this should have been the match at WrestleMania. Even if it ended this lousy, the crowd probably would have popped for it. But I do like the touch of Arnie Skolan coming out with Da Brun. Because he was his manager, and I'm sure he was working in the back, you know, you're sure he was an office guy there smoking stogies or whatever. But yeah, Bruno was underutilized. This ending really sucked, but I do want to make a correction. Big shock. You had mentioned earlier, JR, on December 8th, 1980, when Pedro defeated Ken Patera,
yes,
to win the title. It was also on that night that Da Brun had his last match. He defeated Sergeant Slaughter via countout,
okay,
at 18:38. That
must
was the main event.
Transmittal from England fell apart.
Yeah,
from
exactly. The card was not televised, and something else happened on that night in New York City that will forever sadly live to our good friend Parv and others across the pond, because on another part, on another section of Manhattan on December 8th, 1980, Mark David Chapman stood outside the Dakota building and killed John Lennon.
Really?
On that same night.
From the hospital.
He was what?
Said I was coming home from the hospital.
You were coming home from the hospital, yes. And he was coming home from recording Double Fantasy.
He was
Fantasy.
Headed to the hospital, yes.
Sir. Yeah, and he was. And Mark David Chapman, who had signed his auto, who got autographs earlier in the day, came back, and for some unbelievable reason, which still defies logic, shot him and killed him. He got to the hospital that night, and he died. And Howard Cosell announced it on Monday Night Football when the Patriots were playing. I think they were playing Miami. I think that's what that game was. Anyway, yeah, so it was on that night that not only did Pedro win the IC title, Bruno wrestled his last match at the Garden until now, and John Lennon was assassinated. So,
all right. Any sad, final thoughts on this match from either of you?
David Sammartino looked like a schlub. And, I mean, let's be honest. Come on, Bruno. This was the best you could help your son come up with. I'm sure he helped book this match, and this is what you give? Your son looks like an idiot. I mean, he really does. This is the best you could do. He wins a cheap, lame-o pin. Terrible. Absolutely terrible. If you're gonna give Bubble Butt any kind of advancement, this is the best you do. You accidentally pin the fucking 50-year-old guy, but you couldn't have him beat the younger guy clean. I mean, that
no,
made
no I'm fine
sense.
Not having a not pin Beefcake. I'm fine with. He should beat Johnny V. Like, I agree 100% with that. It's just a stupid way to do it. Like, he doesn't do anything. He just rolls out of the way and then falls on him. It's just, I don't know. There was no hype for it. It comes out of nowhere. Like, with Bruno, you want to build to, like, a super hot tag or something, and they just don't do it. It didn't make any sense.
Right. Anyway. Parv, any last...
Well, I've discovered that Bruno Sammartino had an LJN action figure.
Yes, he did. Yep, he did.
And I've also discovered, a quick correction to earlier, Vince had an action figure, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
In series six. Yeah, I've just been looking.
Series? Jesus.
There were six series, and Vince finally got his own figure. Oh, it's actually really interesting to see who did and did not. Like, Outback Jack had a figure.
Oh, yeah.
Ted Arcidi had a figure.
Uh-huh. Oh, I don't remember Ted Arcidi having a figure. I do remember Outback Jack having a figure.
I remember Ted's, yeah.
Johnny V had a figure.
Yep.
Yes, he did. Yep.
I mean, it's just nuts. There was also referee, brackets, blue shirt. So
really,
yeah, and then referee brackets white shirt, but like just generic ref. Vince also looks nothing like Vince at all.
That's where they stopped. That's a series six.
Yeah, and Hulk obviously is about.
Did he have the blue blazer superstars outfit? What did he have on? Do you have a picture there? Or no?
The classic red, red with blue trousers. The red WWF jacket. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, so, no, just surprise. And there's literally about 20 million different Hulk figures, as you'd imagine. So, yeah. Just surprising the people who do have figures.
It's a fickle game. Okay, let's give our end of show awards here, and then we can wrap things up. Let's go with our match of the night, which to me was easily Hulk Hogan and Magnificent Morocco.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, a very close second to the tag. Both title matches were really good. I would almost give the tag a notch above the world title match, but if you want to break the tie, Parv, I'm gonna go with the tag by a nose over the world title match.
I went with the tag as well.
Oh, you bastards. Hogan Morocco was awesome. All right, I'll give in. I'll capitulate. I'll give you the tag.
I have a feeling I'm going to love the third match, though. When we get to the June House show, I think I'm going to have no problem with
that. You should have loved this one enough to move it ahead.
Oh, come on.
Bunch of jerks. All right, the Drizzler, the worst match of the night, I went with Ivan Putski and Jim Neidhart.
Yeah, that was definitely the Drizzler. That was definitely the Drizzler. Although the third match, the
Pedro was pretty bad too.
The Pedro was pretty drizzly.
The finish of Pedro to me made it better than Neidhart and.
No, I agree with the Pedro match.
he sucked. Yeah, he sucked.
The opener was terrible too.
It was three bad matches in a row. All right, my MVP was Hogan. The way he worked was so unique, and obviously the pop from the crowd and everything.
Yes. Yep. I go with that. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll go. Hogan was special on this card.
The worst worker, I went with, and that is our spoiler award, named after the spoiler who won it on the first show we did. And I went with Ivan Putski. I thought he's very clearly
no doubt
on this card.
No doubt.
David Sammartino.
David's been a little divisive on the show the last couple episodes. Yeah, he's not good, though. He's not good. But I thought Putski was just fucking...
Yeah, he was terrible.
David at least has the ass.
Pedro.
You can't miss David, at least.
Pedro also sucked, I thought.
He did.
There we go.
But I feel bad calling him the worst. Well, maybe I shouldn't after our conversation tonight. I felt bad like putting him there. I thought I was like way off. All right, best moment... I had Bruno cleaning house when he wipes out everyone during some point of the award there.
Yeah, there wasn't any specific moment that stood out tonight. Like Hogan, you could say, but that was the whole ending. I'll go with Bruno there.
I'll go with Lord Al talking up. honestly, I thought many of the best moments happened on commentary. No, I'll go along. I'll play ball.
Okay.
Bruno.
Yeah, I mean, that was a cool moment. His first match since December of 1980. Our Mr. Wonderful Award is our most roided up guy, named after Paul Orndorff because he was our first 2-time winner. So he.
We could have like 7 guys tonight.
It was a tight field tonight. I ended up going with Putski. I thought he was the fact with his age combined with how ripped he was to me made him my choice.
Yeah, that's the only thing. I mean, we could say Tony Atlas, but at least Tony Atlas was still young, and he could have. Yeah, he probably was on something, but at least it was younger and seemed naturally that big. Like I said, if you watched an MSG house show from like '76, Putski's like pasty and fat, and he's like, but he's barrel chested. Here he's like all tan with his fucking hair, and he's
eating, like, it's the kibasa tree. It's the kibasa.
Yes, the kibasa, and he's ripping out of his skin. Oh, there's no doubt. He's like buffet saucing there. I mean, he's borrowing everybody else's stuff. I mean, he looked ridiculous here.
Atlas has got the sort of physique that you'd imagine a man who like only eats chicken has, or something like that. You know, whereas Putski looks like he's been like literally drinking powder or whatever it is. I have to give a special shout out to Rick McGraw, though.
Yes.
Because he's just – nobody has a body like that.
He was actually our first winner on the January 85 MSG card was McGraw.
Yeah, the only reason I mentioned him on this show is just because he like is dwarfed compared to like 6 guys on this show. So, but yeah, no, Rick McGraw just – and by the way, Rick McGraw was on that December 8th, 1980 show as well, getting jobbed in the mid-card. So, well, you were talking You were talking, Parv, about him getting like stalled for so many years. On that night, he was teaming with Angel Marvilla, and he lost to the Moondogs. So I'd be like, where's he gone? Is he gone anywhere in 4.5 years?
I'd love to see him in 85 and then see him in 1980 and see what the difference is. I bet you he's a lot bigger than he was in that 1980 match.
Yeah, I was like,
the fuck is Angel Marvilla?
that's who his tag team partner was. That's ridiculous.
All right. Overall grade on this show. I know I'm going to be lower than you guys. I was just a little disappointed. Like, when they hyped this show up last month, I was so excited for these big three matches. And I felt like all three were just slightly underwhelming. Maybe Hogan Morocco met its expectations. To me, the tag match and the San Martino stuff underwhelmed me. And then you got that sludge in the beginning. When Atlas and Patera is like your next best match after the, I don't know, I went 4.5. I mean, I know I'm maybe a little low, 4.5 out of 10, but I was just left a little disappointed.
I'm going to go slightly higher, but not that much higher. I'll give it a 5. The beginning of the show is atrocious. And I liked Hogan Morocco. I loved the tag. And I liked the main event, but the main event's ruined by that garbage ending. The tag I thought was great, and I just wish Hogan Morocco was like another 3 minutes. But other than that, the rest of the show is not stellar. The missing link stuff was okay, and that beginning stuff was garbage. But yeah, we were talking, JR, when they were reading the card when we were at when we did the April House show, and we heard these matches and we're like, oh my god, this is amazing, and you're like, all right, it was good. So, yeah, I'd give it a 5.
What about you, Parf?
Well, it seems a bit wrong to give a rating to the... I mean, none of these cards you guys are going to watch are going to have any good matches. Just spoilers alert. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, you might get the odd occasional one. Like, that tag match was pretty decent, I thought. But it's kind of like, this is what you're going to get, you know?
Yeah.
It's like 5, 4... Seems about right, but I don't see it. Like, I don't see how these cards are ever going to raise above that. Like, you're not going to get like 4 4-star matches in a row, or even just like 1 4-star match ever. You know, maybe actually, there's a few good matches coming up.
Yeah, and I don't even need that star per se. It's more the expectation of how the expectation of just meeting the hype. I guess is what I'm saying. That's all. Like, I don't need the match to be 4 stars. I need it to be a really fun, like, 2.5, 3. Like, to me, if San Martino, if that finish is different, I feel probably a lot different about the whole card, to be honest with you.
Mm, I agree.
And I know, I feel like there's still too many, of the old Vince Senior guys still knocking around, even at this point in 85. Like, you know, Johnny B. Mm-hmm. Like, the matches that stood out are the matches that have, like, Sheik and Volkov, okay, they're older guys, but US Express, it feels like fresh, new. You wouldn't have had that match in 1982.
Right.
Whereas lots of the rest of the card, literally, you could pick it up and stick it in 82 and it wouldn't look out of place.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's not a lot of has changed. I mean, they're changing a lot of stuff, but the composition of the roster is maybe not changing a ton.
Yeah.
So what do you go with here, Parv? You said a 4 or something like that?
Yeah. Right around where Scott was, I guess, a 5, yeah. Yeah.
All right, why don't we go to wrap things up. Parv, I want to thank you so much for staying up extra late for us here.
Thank you, Parv.
And joining us. It was a pleasure to have you, and we'll have you pick another show soon and rejoin us as soon as you're recharged and want to come back on.
Thanks a lot, and I have to do this because I've been on the show, I've been getting like messages from my things. So Johnny Sorrow says, I just want to hear Parv say, I just want to give a shout out to my homies, the OG Titans crew. And then there's all sorts of like Titans for Life stuff going on. So
we'll have a flurry of Titans on this show. We'll tell you that much. We already have some of them scheduled. So I'll be looking forward to that. Another Titan, Parv, will be on Clotheslines and Headlines this week. Pete will be joining us to talk some CWF Mid-Atlantic with Brad Stutz. And your co-host on Letters from Kayfabe, Alan, will be with us as well, talking his experience at the UK Championship Tournament. So,
all of these guys are overexposed, if you ask me.
not you. And you, of course, can check out those pod blasts weekly here at PlaySimNation.com and the Pro Wrestling Only podcast feed. Newest one dropped today, I believe, is the top tag teams.
Tag team specialists.
Tag team specialists.
Yeah, so So if you want to listen to those, let me know what your takes are, if you disagree with any of them.
There you go. And the next one will come on Thursday, along with Letters from Kayfabe that always drops around midnight on Thursday.
Yeah, well, so the one that it actually drops on Friday.
Okay.
It's called Old School versus New School. And it's basically I review a new match and one of the youngsters, one of the up-and-comers, one of the young lions on the feed, reviews an old match. So there we go. And that's something that in time I hope other hosts will come and do. Even you guys. I'd love to hear Scott review like some, you know, random ROH indie match or whatever, you know.
Be careful what you
it could be fun.
I would pod blast the hell out of you, Parv. So, all right, why don't we go to wrap up, Scott? We are off next week. A little work stuff coming up. So we'll be back 2 weeks' time with the June 1985 MSG House show as we continue our stretch of MSGs here before our next non-MSG show. So we'll be back January 30th with that. Until then, Parv, thank you again. Be sure to check out your accoutrement of shows. Scott, I'll talk to you soon. I'll be back, Closes and Headlines, this Wednesday. Everyone else, take care. Talk to you in a couple weeks. Thank you.